You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Flashpoints.
The U.S. Supreme Court deadlocks on a lower court injunction against Obama's executive action to provide deportation relief to some 6 million undocumented people, mostly from Mexico and Central America. Also, we'll replay our special coverage on the killing and wounding of dozens of supporters of the teachers in southern Mexico. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Up first, we speak with Nativo Lopez, who responds to the decision by the Supreme Court to essentially sustain the lower court's decision to prevent the deportation of the families of the parents of the Dreamers, and millions of other folks are in jeopardy. Listen to this.
Hello, this is Nativo Lopez. I'm a private consultant with the organization Hermandad Mexicana, and there's many hermandades with which I consult, and other organizations on matters related to immigration in the long, many years of advocacy for fair and humane and progressive immigration reform for all immigrants.
Well, now, there's a lot to say about what's going on now and the decision. Obama was at Stanford. There were major protests. The Supreme Court has rejected Obama's program. We all were concerned that people would be set up, their names would be taken, and then at the last minute this would occur. Let me get your first impressions, your response to the Supreme Court and to Obama.
Well, actually, the Supreme Court did not reject the Obama administration executive action. It tied 4-4 for so-called liberal justices or conservative justices, essentially meaning that the injunction that is currently in place that was issued by the lower court judge in Texas and affirmed by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is left in place, meaning that the executive order issued by President Obama to provide temporary administrative relief of deportation to an estimated 5 million undocumented individuals stays in place. So there's no executive order going forward by this administration. The Republican conservatives have essentially been successful in blocking the president's initiative. However, I have a word to say with regard to what the president did. Most people won't remember, but originally the president continued to complain, I'm talking about in 2013, 2014, that he did not have the authority to take executive action to provide relief to undocumented individuals in the United States, that he was at the executive branch, that he could not legislate, and on and on and on. He whined and complained, you know, and commiserated supposedly with people about the massive deportations that were occurring that were actually initiated by his administration. By the end of December of this year, it's estimated that we will reach close to 3 million deportations under this president, more than any other president in the history of the American Republic. 96% of such deportations are of Mexicans and Central Americans. Now, there's something the administration could have done to avoid this defeat at the hands of a split Supreme Court, and that is it could have complied with what's called the Administrative Procedures Act. Meaning that when he issued the original executive order for this program called DACA-DAPA, he could have gone through the Administrative Procedures Act or abided by it, meaning, first and foremost, his executive order, what had been published by the Federal Register of the federal government, which publishes all regulations, legislation, and proposed regulations to implement legislation. So that would have been the first step, publish his executive order with the Federal Register, allowed a 30 to 60 day comment period in which anyone from the public could make their comments known by sending in mailing or emailing their comments during that period. And then after that period, you close it, and then you move forward to execute the executive order, taking into consideration any of the comments, opinions, observations made by anyone in the public, or ignoring them completely and simply executing the executive order and implementing it effectively, allowing such relief to reach the millions of undocumented in the United States. He did not do that. He just went directly to execute the executive order, and that's what the state of Texas and 26 other governors of other states challenged, that the president violated the Administrative Procedures Act. The injunction that was approved by the lower court essentially prevented the administration from moving forward with the program until the issues brought to the court by the 26 states were litigated. So now with a split decision of the Supreme Court, the case will return to the lower court, the injunction in place, and the litigation will move forward in that court. What I want to make clear to the public, Dennis, is that the 26 states, they have not even raised the constitutional issues that they have related to the action taken by the president. What will be litigated first is whether the president violated the Administrative Procedures Act, and if it was found in that particular lower court that he did violate that act, then the whole executive order will be thrown out. They could still come back and take another bite of the apple and challenge the constitutional authority of the executive branch to issue such executive orders as they relate to immigration matters. So that's pretty much the lay of the land. And I'm personally of the opinion, and many of the other organizations that I work with that have advocated over the years, for the last 40 years, for example, are also of the opinion that the administration erred. In fact, when he first issued the executive order, we were preparing to issue our comments related to the executive action, anticipating that it would have gone through the Administrative Procedures Act, something that we know we're very familiar with because we went through this back in 1985-86 when the amnesty legislation was passed under the Ronald Reagan presidency. So we were actually flabbergasted that it did not go that route. That would have avoided and prevented this type of challenge, and some even have the view of a conspiratorial nature that perhaps the administration did it purposely, knowing that it would be challenged, and he could turn around and blame the Republicans for not being able to provide the administrative leave to the undocumented immigrants of the country.
All right, Nativo. Now, this policy, whether he did it as a political ploy or just because he was naive and thought that was the way to go, the policy has included the kind of program that has got him, earned him the title of deporter and chief. This kind of policy is creating endless suffering. So here, again, we have a situation of, if I understand it correctly, the dreamers are protected, but their families are in deep trouble and in jeopardy. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. Such that I omitted to explain that those that obtain the DACA permit, which is essentially a work permit, a administrative relief against deportation, that program continues. That was enacted in 2012. That continues. Those folks are young people are protected. Individuals that actually come of age and meet all the other requirements of that executive order will also be able to obtain that protection. But again, their parents will not because of the non-decision, you can put it, of the Supreme Court. That would have applied to parents of U.S.-born children or permanent residents of the United States. So, those parents are in jeopardy. Those families are continuing to be assaulted by this administration, continuing to be deported. And so the call that has gone out by organizations throughout the country to the Obama administration is to stop the deportations. If he was not capable of making this happen in a manner successfully, that at least he can stop the deportation and separation of families and the continued of U.S.-born children who are forced to accompany their deported Mexican parents and Central American parents. Today, it's estimated there's 800,000 U.S.-born children who are forced to accompany their Mexican deported parents back to Mexico. Now they reside in Mexico as undocumented in Mexico, but they don't have status. They're not Mexicans. They're Americans. Even though we love to say we're Mexican-Americans, we're Chicanos, we're Latinos, et cetera, in the United States, these are American children, minors, that were forced exile to accompany their parents to Mexico and now reside in Mexico without any status.
Wow. Now, let me ask you, you're somebody who's thought about these kinds of policies for a long time and has been fighting this fight for a long time. This is the Obama administration with Hillary Clinton and the Republicans. This is perhaps the worst time in modern history in terms of the way we're treating our brothers and sisters from the South. This is really a tragedy. How would you talk about this?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's worse than a tragedy. It's perverse because in 1986, the last major immigration reform that occurred that resulted in the legalization of close to 3 million undocumented individuals had a pretty benevolent benefit to the undocumented population. All other legislation that we've seen since that time has been has not reached the threshold of benevolence of that legislation that occurred under the Reagan administration.
So this is Ronald Reagan who proved that he could do it with an executive order.
He did multiple executive orders to provide protection for immigrants that were either refugees or didn't qualify for the amnesty legislation, but were family members of an individual that qualified for amnesty. So we haven't been able to improve on that, notwithstanding Democratic and Republican administrations. Obviously, the Clinton administration, you know, Papa Bush and baby George Bush, and now the Obama administration, notwithstanding all of his promises that he made to the immigrant community, and that's what earned him the name Deporter in Chief, because he has done more to separate families than any other president in the history of America. And never have we seen during his administration Democratic legislators, senators, and members of the House of Representatives conduct a sit-in protesting against the deportations of their president of their party, the manner in which they conducted the sit-in to wail and whine and cry about the possession of firearms by Americans as occurred during this week. So we were hopeful that longtime civil rights activist John Lewis, you know, would lead a protest of that character in the chamber of the House against President Obama for the deportations. But never did we see it. Never have we heard that John Lewis would even contemplate taking such action and being critical of his own president.
And now we have Hillary Clinton as the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party. Are you concerned, given her own history, her actions in Honduras, in Central America? Do you have concerns about this issue if she is elected president?
Excuse me, Dennis, are you referring to Hillary Send Them Home Clinton?
Yes.
That's the same Secretary of State that declared on national television in response to the unaccompanied minors from Central America crossing the U.S. border seeking refuge because they were victims of human trafficking, abuse, narco trafficking. And her response to that situation was send them home. And if I'm not mistaken, she's a mother. She claims to be a feminist. She's a grandmother. She's a wife. All the feminine characteristics or embodiment of a person that would seemingly be more sensitive to the plight of unaccompanied minor fleeing violence, trafficking, etc. And this woman had the gall to declare on national television to send them home. Now she's making all types of promises. The first 100 days, we heard that before. That she would aggressively pursue immigration reform. This is the same woman that has supported as Secretary of State all the policies of deportation and incarceration of her president. And yes, the same woman that supported the coup in Honduras that eventually led to the assassination of Berta Cáceres. And what we've heard of late, that soldiers that were ordered to pursue the assassination of Berta, some of them have come forward and revealed that it was really a military operation. So that is directly linked to the coup. That is directly linked to the support of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to that occurrence in Honduras. And who would believe this woman, or who would trust anything that she would say today in her rabid bid to become the president of the United States?
She was also lecturing the parents of Honduras and Guatemala about how could they be so cruel as to send their children north on such a dangerous trip. They need to take better care of their children.
Yeah, well, all of her policies led to the flight, you know, and these literally tens of thousands of individuals fleeing Honduras seeking refuge in the United States. And she essentially rejected them. So, no, she's unfortunately, you know, she is not an option, you know, for American voters. Neither is the other guy, Trump, an option for the American people. And it's unfortunate that the American people now will be cajoled into the argument, vote for the lesser of two evils. I like to repeat to people what Ralph Nader said a number of years ago, Jerry Brown, when he was the candidate, that were transfixed with the situation of supporting the evil of two lessers. And that's essentially what the American people will be faced in November, apparently.
All right, Nativo Lopez, as always, it's a pleasure and an honor to speak with you. Very enlightening. We're going to watch it very closely, and you be careful. We'll talk to you soon.
Dennis.
Bye-bye now. We'll be right back. listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We continue our special coverage of the violence being perpetrated by the Mexican government against the teachers who are opposing neoliberal policies that will destroy the traditional and very highly valued educational system. We spoke first with Alejandro Reyes. He was in Chiapas. He's our special correspondent for that part of the world, and he is an expert in human rights. He's based in Chiapas. Here's Alejandro Reyes.
On Sunday, there was a very brutal repression on the part of the federal police against teachers, students, relatives, parents of the students, as well as many people from civil society who had been who have set up a blockade, a roadblock, for a week now on the highway that goes from Oaxaca City to Puebla and Mexico City, so an important highway. Now, they have been blocking it for a week, as there have been blockades in many places around the country, in protest against the educational reforms and trying to force the government into negotiating them and backing down from them. The federal police arrived at about 8 in the morning, and at some point they started shooting. The first they attacked the demonstrators with rubber bullets and tear gas. But then they started firing live bullets at them with large weapons, apparently AR-15s and handguns, 380s, directly at the population. While this was unfolding, the federal police were on Twitter were saying that there were an external armed group that was firing, that it was not them. Images started circulating on the social media and Facebook and so on of the police firing with high-power weapons, the police denying all of this. The result of that was that 8 people died at the moment. We have 8 people confirmed so far. One person died yesterday from complications, so there are 9 people dead confirmed so far. Over 50, 60 people injured, some of them very seriously injured, whose situation we still don't know. And over 20 people who have been disappeared, in other words, taken by the police, and we have no idea of their whereabouts. So this was the brutal repression that took place on Sunday. After these images started circulating on the the media, on social media, the police and the governor of Oaxaca finally made a statement the night of on Sunday night, saying that yes, indeed, they had fired weapons. You know, they couldn't deny this anymore, but they claimed there was an external group who started firing first and was firing not only at the police but also at the population, and therefore they had to protect the population. This has been, of course, there were many, many eyewitnesses on location, and it has been confirmed that this is absolutely false and that this is a lie on the part of the government. The only people that were armed with firearms were the police.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Alejandro Reyes. Talked to us from Chiapas. He's been watching very closely, covering, reporting on, doing human rights work around the recent killing, the opening fire of the teachers. Now, I just want to ask you a question about the people who disappeared. Who is it that disappeared? Do we, are these folks that the government has been trying to undermine? Are these significant players? Are these people? What do we know about those folks?
We have the names. The teachers' union, the CNTE, has published the name of 22 people who are missing. And we don't know the details of who they are. They are people that were present in the demonstration that were detained by the federal police at the moment.
So we don't know where they are, whether they're dead or alive, whether they're being tortured. But we do know that the government has decided to use lethal force to repress this community. I note that in a statement from the teachers, it reads, "Education is the only weapon of the people. Those of the government are the instruments of death and repression. Who is the criminal? Feelings are strong." It was announced by medical workers, doctors and nurses, that they will, in solidarity, hold major protests on Sunday. You want to talk about the reverberations of this attack on these courageous teachers?
Yeah, there has been a lot of mobilizations throughout the country. Yesterday, there were many mobilizations. There are some today. There is a major march scheduled in many places tomorrow. So people have been rising up in many places. In Oaxaca, in the region of the Istmo de Tehuantepec, in the region of the refineries in Salina Cruz, the blockade that has been going on for 8 days, they were also removed on Sunday. They are back blocking the road again. So there has been an uproar of indignation throughout the country. You're correct in saying that the health sector is now joining. They had actually already been participating in marches and so on, but they have now joined with greater force, again, because one of the key reforms, the constitutional reforms, is also a health reform that will be affecting many people. And as a result of all of this, the government has said that there will be negotiations. There is a negotiation table set up for tomorrow. However, the Secretary of Education has, on one hand, not participate in the negotiations, and on the other, he is saying that there will be no backing down whatsoever from the educational reform, that this is a political negotiation and not a negotiation in terms of the education reform. And, of course, this is not at all what the teachers or the population is seeking. We have a feeling that they're going to try to buy off the leaders to deflect attention from things. If the government is not really willing to serious negotiation on the issue of the educational reform, I don't think this is going to go very far.
You know, I'm looking, Alejandro, at the corporate press. I think this is a rip and read from the BBC. And it's so interesting the way this story is misreported. The opening line of the BBC is 8 people have died as if they weren't shot down. 8 people have died after teacher protests turned violent in the Mexican state of Oaxaca. How would you say that? Teacher protests turn violent. Doesn't it seem like they're blaming the teachers for getting violent? And then the government comes in, and they are quoting government sources all through this article.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with the media internationally, that often they pick up the statements from the government, and of course that gives you one particular view of the issue, and as we know, they've been lying blatantly about all of this, as they have done for 2 years regarding Ayotzinapa. So I think it's not a very serious reporting on part of international media and national media here in Mexico, which just pick up government statements.
Now, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in the country. You know, we're talking about the medical workers. We're now hearing reports that this is really reverberating through the country. Very little is being reported north of the border, but these teachers are revered. This is one of the oldest unions in the country. So this is not going unnoticed by very many people.
Yeah, there has been a very, very strong, very serious campaign of this information, and many large media here in Mexico are picking it up in very crude ways, trying to criminalize the teachers, and this has been going on for years now, trying to depict them as lazy, as underprepared, and people who are violent and mediocre and so on. You know, there's very ugly depictions from the media, as well as sort of means to distract public attention, like the false communique by the EZLN, which claimed that the EZLN was rising up in arms together with the teachers and that there was going to be a bloodbath in the country, which was a false communique leaked by the government. So all of this is aimed at associating the image of the teachers as both mediocre and dangerous. And to a certain extent, it had been somewhat successful with at least part of the population. The power of the two major TV stations, Televisa and TV Azteca, is very, very significant. What surprises, I think, is that despite this very intense campaign of disinformation, there are many, many people in the country that are joining, and the movement seems to be growing and multiplying. So this is really an indication, on one hand, of a growing awareness on the part of the population of what is going on, a show of strength on the part, strength and coherence on the part of the teachers' movement, which is seen by the population despite the disinformation campaign, and also the teachers' movement by spreading throughout so many states in the country is allowing a means of expression for the very, very large anger in the Mexican population regarding many other issues beyond education. So it's a really interesting phenomenon, and so far the government's position has done nothing but inflame people's rage even further.
Let me ask you, Alejandro, about you're in Chiapas now. We know that this is the land of Zapatistas. I understand that they have responded, that there has been a global statement put out. Could you tell us a little bit about how this is reverberating right where you're on the ground speaking to us now?
Yes, certainly, Dennis. After that false communique that was circulated by the government, the Zapatistas came out with their own communique, expressing solidarity with the teachers' movement. And since then, there have been two other communiques, one that came out yesterday, calling the population to be very attentive and to mobilize throughout the country in support of the teachers. This is a call for nonviolent mobilization. It's very important to emphasize that the Zapatistas have been going on for a very long time now on a peaceful resistance project, and all of their initiatives have been in that sense, including the upcoming two-week event on arts that will happen in late July. So there's this notion that the government is trying to associate between Zapatismo and violence is absolutely false. They are, however, calling on the Mexican population to rise up peacefully through mobilizations and direct actions of resistance, you know, throughout the country in support of the teachers. This will have an effect, at least on a significant part of the population, which is attentive and follows the path of the Zapatistas, or at least is in accordance with their ideals and their goals of resistance and change for Mexico. In Chiapas, of course, it has a very significant impact because their presence is felt very strongly here.
And in terms of the teachers themselves, you were talking about, we were talking about how they were respected, revered, people responding to them. And this, we talked about this a little yesterday, but, you know, there's still the suffering, there's still the battle to find out what happened when those other teachers and student teachers were disappeared because a local provisional politician was upset with what they were up to. The teachers are really part of the fabric of the society, the hope in the society, particularly this union. And they have a real history in this regard, right?
Yes, Dennis, and this whole issue of Ayotzinapa also speaks of the indignation that is running in the country. There is, I think, very, very evident for most people in Mexico that we're no longer talking about a government that has been corrupted by organized crime. which was sort of the narrative that was used for Ayotzinapa at first. In other words, that the mayor of Iguala had been somehow corrupted by organized crime, and therefore he put in action the local police, which were at his service, and disappeared. And, 43 students murdered, three more, and three other people. People in Mexico are now realizing, and or many, many people have realized, that this is not the right narrative. The narrative is that organized crime and the government are the same thing. We're not talking about a war against drugs. We're not talking about a war against organized crime or infiltration of crime in the government instances. The government and organized crime are the very same thing. And so when you have this teachers' movement throughout the country rising up against government, and the government continuing to use the discourse of legality, the Estado de Derecho, and how important it is to uphold legality and constitutionality in the country, you feel this as an offense. You know, it's an insult when you hear this from the government, from this government. And so I think that explains a lot, you know, this indignation that people have carried. And I've heard people even very conservative, you know, very much in the right wing, who, when you talk about Ayotzinapa, ache because of the unspeakable pain that it would that it means for those relatives who have lost their children and have no idea where they are, whether they are dead, whether they're being tortured, whether, you know, the same thing is happening as happened to one of them, which was found without his face and his eyes, which apparently was torn from him while he was alive. You know, this kind of horror. And this, we're talking about, you know, these events being done by the police, by Mexican institutions. And so the anger in the population is so much that is one of the explanations why we're seeing what we're seeing right now.
All right. We urge you to be careful. We appreciate the good information, and we look forward to talking to you soon. Please be careful.
Thank you, Dennis. It's a pleasure being with you.
All right. Bye-bye now. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we continue our special coverage of Mexico. We spoke with Anda La Lucha in Oaxaca on Wednesday late with this update. She lets us know what really happened on the ground and helps to unfold the lies being perpetrated by the Mexican government. Here's Anda La Lucha in Oaxaca.
My name is Andalusia Nolasolas. I'm a freelance journalist based here in Mexico, and I just came down to Oaxaca a few days ago to report on the repression and the teachers movement and the popular movement that is happening here. I got here on Monday, and right now I am in Nochitlan, which is a town about an hour outside of Mexico City, and this is where the repression was against a blockade that the teachers had erected. At least 8 people were killed in that blockade, and actually almost all of them were residents of Nochitlan, because the residents had come out when they had heard about the repression on Sunday. They had come out to support the teachers, and it was that they had come out, many people who I've interviewed, they were young, mostly, I think all were, no, not 100% sure, but I think almost all were men. They were young men, and they came out to help the people that were injured. One family I talked to today, their son, Jesus Cadena, he was 19 years old, and he went in an ambulance to try to help and, you know, provide first aid or bring people to a hospital. And when he arrived at the blockade, he was killed by the police.
When he arrived at the blockade, he was killed by the police.
Yes.
Could you say a little bit more about, set that scene up a little bit. So this was a strike by the, this was an action by the teachers. The community came out. The government is saying there were some unnamed gunmen or gunfire coming from somewhere. And so the security forces, the Mexican forces, had no choice but to open fire. Give us your information about what you've been able to learn.
Sure. And just to take one step backwards to give a little more context.
Yes.
So this comes in the context of the teachers' movement over the past 3 years has been mobilizing across Mexico against what they see as neoliberal economic reforms, which basically affect their labor rights and also really put schools and teachers that are in marginalized communities at a disadvantage. So they have been protesting for years against the education reform since it was introduced 3 years ago when the new president, Enrique Peña Nieto, entered into power. And so, I mean, the recently is when the reform really went into effect, and the teachers have been mobilizing more, mostly in the states of Chiapas, Michoacan, and Oaxaca. And here in Oaxaca, the teachers union has a history of radical uprisings and movements. 10 years ago, it was here, the movement of the APO was part of where it started with a teachers' encampment in the city of Oaxaca, and then became a larger popular movement that was calling for the governor to resign, among many other demands. And so this actually last week marked the 10-year anniversary of this popular movement from 2006, and also two of the leaders of the CENTE, which is the teachers union here in the CENTE section 22, the teachers union here in Oaxaca, were arrested. So the teachers, in response to these arrests and the repression, and also in response to the education reform in general, they blockaded one of the major highways that goes from Mexico City to Oaxaca City. And this blockade they erected in the town of Nochitlan. And so the teachers held the blockade for about a week. And then it was that the police came on Sunday because they wanted to open the highway. So hundreds and hundreds of federal police, of riot police, arrived. As you could see, I mean, I was not here, but you could see that in all the photos and all the testimonies. And it was then when they had started really firing lots of gas. And I'm not sure exactly, there's a ton of different testimonies about what time they opened fire, but that it definitely was earlier in the day. And that's when many of the residents of the town of Nochitlan, and also parents of students that go to the schools that these teachers, you know, work at, came out to really support the blockade and to, you know, protest the police action. And that the police and the government have been saying that these group, you know, this unknown group of people came and opened fire. There is not a single proof of that. There is tons of proof, photographic proof and video proof, that the police were firing from early on in the day on the protesters. There is not one single proof, photographic proof or any other proof, that some mystery group arrived and opened fire. I mean, I think it's just the government is trying to save face and say whatever they can to make it seem that they didn't just come and massacre 8 people in a town where people, you know, I mean, were armed at best with, you know, rocks, maybe some fireworks, and maybe some people had Molotov cocktails. But beyond that, there was not the general population. There's no documentation that they were armed beyond that. And the police were armed with assault weapons and pistols and, you know, I mean, a wide range of firearms.
So you're saying that those who were wounded and killed were local residents. Were any of the teachers killed?
No, they were all local residents.
So it was all local residents who had come out to support the blockade in support of the teachers. And why would the residents be such strong supporters? Why would they come out on behalf of the teachers?
I mean, I think it's also, it's a culmination of things, and this is what many of the residents have said to me who I've interviewed, that this isn't just about the educational reform. I think it's that the teachers, and this is what also happened in 2006, what started, you know, as teachers protesting certain reforms that affect their jobs and their fields of work, then expand kind of like that there's this popular movement and people think, oh, you know, actually here in the schools, we don't have any of the services we need. Our students don't get a good education. There's not enough, you know, there's not enough jobs. There's really intense poverty in many places in Oaxaca. So from what I understood from and the many residents that I interviewed, it kind of became like a general discontent with the government and general discontent with the reforms and discontent of what's happening in general in Mexico with violations of human rights, with lack of education, with lack of access to jobs. I mean, even basic services right here today, they're saying that there was protests of people saying that in their neighborhood, there's no water. In Oaxaca City today, there's protests of medical workers and doctors and nurses who are saying that, you know, they've gotten like certain reforms have cut their salaries and their ability to provide care. So I think it's just there's a general discontent. And so that was part of the reason why many of these residents came out to support the teachers. And then the other reason is that they support the teachers. I mean, 90% of them have students, you know, have children that are students at the schools of which the teachers work. And then also, I think many of them did just come out because they heard that there were, you know, injured people. So just out of a general solidarity, regardless if they were teachers or who they were, but just to help people that were in need.
And have you been able to interview any of those who were wounded or the family members of those who were hurt or killed?
Yes, I interviewed two of the family members of those who were killed.
Can you please share a little bit about who these people are, something about themselves and their what they were saying about this attack, please?
Sure. So I just interviewed Patricia Sanchez. She's the mother of Jesus Cadena. He was 19 years old. He was just about to enter the university to study to become an engineer. And he actually had not been participating in the blockade at all. And that day he said to his mom, look, they really need our help. He went to the church that was calling upon people to go out and help. And from the church, he actually got into an ambulance to go and help the people who were injured. And when he got there, that was when they said that he was killed. And then his mother went and, you know, went out into the fields into the blockade looking for him. And then was told that her son had been killed.
He was killed on his way to the ambulance or?
No. The ambulance, he got to the blockade where the police were firing on people.
I see. Go on, please.
And the police were firing from all different directions. I mean, I arrived on Monday, you know, one day after the large police repression and the people were killed, and I arrived, and everywhere we went, different teachers and residents, et cetera, showed us the bullet casings and showed us tear gas canisters and showed us where they were firing. So, I mean, we had gone to a cemetery, and the caretaker of the cemetery showed us that the federal police came in, held a gun to his head, and took his cell phone away and cursed at him and told him that they were going to kill him if he did anything, and then started opening fire on the protest from within the cemetery. And he showed us where there was like a round of bullet casings on the ground there. Returning to speaking about the victims.
Before you go to what did the mom say? What more did she say about this? I guess she was distraught in mourning, but what was she saying? Tell us a little bit more about that, please.
Sure. I mean, she's, of course, destroyed, you know, I mean, and crying a lot and can't believe that, you know, her son was taken from her. And she said in that her son was always someone who wanted to help people so much that he said that when he died, he wanted to donate his organs and that he was really healthy and hoped that if he had, you know, died, that he would be able to donate his organs. And she said, why did my son have to die like this? And now I can't even donate his organs to anyone. And so she just said, I mean, you know, she said, okay, well, what will happen now? You know, because the president, Peña Nieto, he did send out some tweets, you know, saying, oh, my regrets are with the family, et cetera. And she said, okay, and what are your regrets to? Maybe you should have come here in the first place to talk to the teachers before sending in, you know, thousands of police to come and kill us. And what are you going to do? You can't send back my son. I can't get my son back. So what happens next? And she said, you know, how will there be justice? I don't care if they fire, you know, the person who ordered the attack. I don't care. She's like, there will be no justice. justice. And I think just not only that no one could return her son to her, but that also there is no, there is lots of impunity in Mexico. Over the past 3 years, there's been in many, many different situations, including Ayotzinapa, the case of the 43 disappeared students, including Tlatlaya, where military soldiers opened on a group of men and then claimed that they had first opened on the soldiers. And in both of these cases, there's been almost total impunity. So I think this impunity just sets the stage so that other people who have family members who have been victims of state violence think that nothing will happen. And they have all the reason in the world to think that, because there is not, Mexico does not have a good track record. It has all the great laws in the world on the books, but in actual implementation, there is nothing to show that Mexico actually tries to bring those responsible for these human rights violations or massacres, assassinations, et cetera, to justice.
So just to make sure, the mom's name and the son who was killed, please tell us again. We want to know the spelling so people remember who was murdered here.
Jesus Cadena. Cadena.
Mm-hmm. All right. And you were saying that there's a...
And Patricia Sanchez is his mother.
Patricia Sanchez. And you were saying that there was a another person, a family, or that who was killed,
right,
or wounded.
Correct.
Tell us about that, please.
Okay. And the second person that I referred to, where we interviewed his family, who also, I mean, it's important to mention that a lot of people really fear repression here, and they fear speaking out about the repression. Most people have not wanted to be filmed on camera. They only allow it to film from behind, or they don't want to give their names. The father didn't want to give his name. He didn't want any family photos to be shown. And he told us his son was 23 years old. They were not a family that really had been participating in the teachers movement, but that his son said, you know, I'm just really fed up. I'm fed up with what's happening in Mexico. I'm fed up what's happening in my town, and I want to go out and I'm going to go help the teachers. And pretty much from what we understand, his son went out. He had just left the house, and upon arriving closer to the barricades and the blockade, he was killed.
He was killed. Oh, my God. All right. So what's your best understanding of the situation now? I know that the teachers are mobilizing. We know that the medical workers are mobilizing. Give us a sense of the growing response to this.
I mean, there are people who have been protesting all over the country, including the world. I mean, I know a friend, a lot of Mexicans that are in other parts of the world have been organizing protests. And actually, there was just arbitrary detentions the other day in Mexico City of, I think, at least 6 people, perhaps 9 or more, who went to protest at, like, the government, the office of Oaxaca, their representation in Mexico City. And they were just arbitrarily detained, including an independent journalist from, like, a media collective called Subversiones was also among the detained. So this was people, you know, showing their discontent with what happened in the repression of Oaxaca, and they also were detained in Mexico City. Fortunately, by now they have been released, but this is, I think, it doesn't happen that 8 people are murdered, and that there seems to be all the proof that it was, you know, the federal police who killed them. And right now, here where I am, I'm at, like, a school where different teachers are gathering, and also people, human rights workers, government human rights workers, and they're here to document what happened, you know, and determine what was there, this mystery armed group, or really was it at the hands of the police, all of this repression. There's also in Mexico City, there were other protesters all across Oaxaca. There's been blockades in the center of Oaxaca City, in surrounding towns, in what's the isthmus of Oaxaca, El Istmo, in Uchitán. There's been blockades, and I'm pretty sure that also one young man was killed there. And so, I mean, this is something that is escalating. It's not just about educational reform. I mean, I see it in many ways. It is a repeat of 2006, where it started maybe with the teachers movement, but is expanding into a larger popular movement.
And so people are very aware. They might not have the specific terminology, but they know what, in real terms, what neoliberalism is, what free trade is, and what the impact is going to be if these institutions like the teachers union and the way in which people become teachers are undermined by government policies. Correct. This is the front line of the battle.
Correct. I mean, I think that there's really also been an economic crisis, which people in Mexico know is related to, you know, oil prices, and that the peso, before, NAFTA was worth 10 pesos to the dollar. Now it's almost 20 pesos to the dollar, you know, and this has really affected people's purchasing power. Minimum wage has not gone up in 30 years, and actually people's purchasing power is almost 70% less than it was. People, the teachers in many communities, I mean, Oaxaca is a rural state. It's a largely indigenous state, and there is a lot of rural poverty, and these are places where there's not even highways that will take, you know, paved roads for people. There's many communities that don't have electricity, they don't have computers, and really teachers in these rural isolated communities play a very, very important role in the communities. And so people know that, like, if the teachers are really already paid horrible wages, and that one thing that at least they had was job security, and now they don't even have that job security. And then also the government, part of the reform was that then the parents would have to pay for more school supplies, and really that the parents would have to, like, take more of the economic burden on. And so I think that the parents are really starting to feel that and know that maybe they don't know that this is neoliberalism, but they do know that it is financially affecting them, and that they are against it, you know, and that they are against. There is a very strong current in all of Mexico to defend. And I think it's just also important to know, like, teachers, this movement, the CENTE Section 22, has for many, many years or decades been like a strong leftist institution. And there are, you know, many people that grew up with their families being teachers, or their aunts or their uncles, and are therefore willing kind of to support this teachers movement.
All right. And just finally, you said you're at a school where people have come together. There's organizing going on. There are reports that there's going to be a major protest called by the medical workers. What do you understand people are saying, people are planning? Are there protests, major protests now being planned?
I mean, what's been planned right now are some of the different blockades. I know that there's a protest later in Oaxaca City as five.
As what? I'm sorry, we lost you. There's
in Oaxaca City.
Yeah.
There's a larger protest that will be later, I think, in the city of Oaxaca. There's also an encampment in the Zocalo of the city where the teachers are, and then many people have been arriving there. And here, people have been from all over the country sending support, you know, sending supplies, sending food, sending water to support the teachers. You are here in Nochislan, and also the family.
All right. I want to thank you very much, Anda La Lucha. How do people follow your work and your reporting? What's the best way to keep track of you? Are you on the web?
I am. You could follow me on Twitter at Anda La Lucha, or follow me also on Tumblr, Anda La Lucha. And also, I am a frequent contributor to AJ Plus, Vice News, TRT World, and Democracy Now!
I want to thank you so much for being with us on Flashpoints today.
All right, great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Be careful. Bye-bye.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear part two of Adam Curtis's new film, Bitter Lake, condensed and adapted to radio by yours truly. It's about the modern history of the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and especially Afghanistan. It's about the unintended consequences of U.S. Middle Eastern policy. It's about how Afghanistan is probably unconquerable and possibly even ungovernable. In this week's portion, the film draws some nice parallels between what Russia tried and failed to do for Afghanistan in the 1980s and what the U.S. is trying and failing to do today. And it shows how the policies of both Saudi Arabia and the U.S. created Afghanistan's most famous resident, the late Osama bin Laden. We'll pick up where we left off, about 1980. Afghanistan's homegrown revolutionary government is collapsing, and the country is descending into chaos. The Soviet Union has dispatched to Afghanistan not only troops, but advisors, teachers, doctors, and engineers, trying to build a new, maybe utopian, Afghanistan. Good luck with that, comrades. And now you can say the very same to us.
President Reagan simplified everything for America. For 10 years, the country had been battered and torn apart by waves of economic and social chaos. Reagan set out to give the country a new sense of purpose. He took all the problems, even the most complex, and turned them into reassuring moral fables. And abroad, the world he depicted was one where, although good might struggle with evil for a while, in the end, goodness and innocence would triumph.
We have it in our power to begin the world over again.
It was a vision of the world that over the next 20 years would rise up to possess all of us in the West, both left and right. Conflicts that in the past would have been seen as political struggles were redefined. They became instead battles against dark demonic forces that threatened innocent people. And the role of we, the good people of the West, was to intervene to save those innocents. One of the places this dream began was Afghanistan. America was already helping the rebels who were fighting the Russians. But Reagan increased the aid massively and made it the symbol of his new vision. He even dedicated the space shuttle to the Afghan freedom fighters.
Just as the Columbia, we think, represents man's finest aspirations in the field of science and technology, so too does the struggle of the Afghan people represent man's highest aspirations for freedom. Accordingly, I am dedicating, on behalf of the American people, the March 22nd launch of the Columbia to the people of Afghanistan.
But right from the beginning, there was a dangerous, destructive force at the very heart of this project. This was because Reagan's partner in the battle to bring freedom to Afghanistan was Saudi Arabia. The Saudi intelligence agencies worked with the CIA to ship arms and money to the Afghan rebels. On the surface, the Saudis did this because a fellow Muslim country had been invaded by communists. But it was also part of their attempt to export the dangerous fundamentalism at the heart of their own society. In 1979, a group of Saudi radicals had taken over the Grand Mosque in Mecca. For 2 weeks, the authorities had fought running battles with the insurgents. They discovered that a number of the attackers had been taught by the most senior religious leader in the country. It made the ruling family realize just how fragile their grip on power was. So, as well as sending them money and the weapons, they encouraged young radicals to go and fight in Afghanistan. One of them was a young Osama bin Laden. The aim was to divert their anger. But it meant that with the arms would also come the pessimistic and intolerant version of Islam, Wahhabism. To begin with, these ideas would have little influence in Afghanistan. But they would take hold there and mutate into a dark and violent force that was completely at odds with Reagan's vision of freedom. At the beginning, though, no one knew who to give the weapons to. And an odd group of adventurers went into Afghanistan to find out. One of the first was a Texan socialite called Joanne Herring.
When I went into Afghanistan, I don't even know how I got in. The president of Pakistan flew me to the border, you know, the no man's land that the British created very wisely between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we boarded a truck. I put on men's clothing, and we got on this truck and went somewhere. And we went into these camps, and there would be these men with beards and turbans and in rags, really. They had nothing. And there with their 1918 Enfield rifles, and they would stand there and they'd say, "To the last drop of blood." And your heart would just burst. But I thought, what will they do with an unveiled woman coming in here? And I thought, you know, they really may kill me because they might not understand why I'm here. But they did. They were so grateful, so grateful. They said, "The world doesn't know. Thank you for coming." My heart was given immediately to these people who believe so much in their God. And I think it's the same God as I worship, just in another way. And they would come back, and of course, completely exhausted and almost dead, and those who were still alive. And then this new group would say, "I can't wait to go out and kill Russians."
This is Radio Afghanistan calling Europe.
This is Radio Afghanistan Kabul, and here is the news. 43 cases of bullets for 303 bore guns and Egyptian Kalashnikov, 11,300 other bullets of various types, including rocket launchers and mines, and 170 various types of weapons, 45 mortar shells, light and heavy machine guns, typewriters and cameras have recently been seized from the counter-revolutionary bandits and different...
In the early 1980s, the Soviet Union was falling apart. The attempt to create a planned socialist society had failed. It had become a stagnant world, where the shops were half empty, criminal gangs looted the factories, and no one believed in the system any longer. The aging Soviet leaders knew that Russian society was collapsing, but they had no idea what to do. And in the face of this, Afghanistan became for them a last desperate attempt to create a model version of their original communist ideal. Faced with a growing rebellion in the countryside, the Russians took over Afghanistan and installed another student revolutionary as president. He was called Babrak Kamal, and he did what he was told. And as well as the Russian troops, thousands of teachers and doctors came to set up programs and hospitals that were going to transform the lives of the Afghan people.
Why did you come to Afghanistan? Was it compulsory posting, or was it of your own free choice?
Why I did come to Afghanistan? Okay, I will tell you. I'm a doctor. I want to help people, patient. It is the main reason why I come to Afghanistan. Do you satisfied?
But it was your own free choice that you came here. Yes, you were not sent.
Only free choice. Nothing.
And Afghan women were taught to be independent,
so they could free themselves from the repression of what the Soviets saw as a backward religion.
You know, after the revolution, the women in Afghanistan will be same like men, yes? They are the same. You know what I mean? You know, in society and also in economy and everything.
But outside the cities, the Mujahideen rebels increased their attacks. They were becoming more confident and powerful. Using weapons supplied by the Americans and the Saudis, they ambushed Russian convoys. The Mujahideen treatment of their Russian prisoners was ruthless and cruel.
And we captured two Russians alive. Then we took them to our commander. And then the commander told us to stone them into death. And we took them and we stoned them into death.
They stoned them to death?
Yeah, yes.
Have many people here stoned Russians or Afghan communists to death?
In response, the Russians launched search and destroy missions, often bombing whole villages, massacring hundreds of civilians. The war became a vicious struggle, with the Mujahideen using equally brutal tactics. And any idea of transforming Afghanistan began to slip away, and the Russians retreated into the cities.
Comrade General, what is the military situation in the country?
But the rebels came into the cities and began to kill the Russian civilians. They hid bombs in everyday objects that exploded the moment anyone used them. Everything around the Russians became frightening and unstable. The forces that they had unleashed were pursuing them, and as they did so, they began to eat away at the very foundations of Soviet communism. One of the bravest and most honest of the Russian journalists in Afghanistan was Artyom Borovik. He wrote, "We thought that we were civilizing a backwards country by exposing it to television, to modern bombers, to schools, to the latest models of tanks, to books, to long-range artillery, to newspapers, to economic aid, to AK-47s. But we rarely stopped to think how Afghanistan would influence us. Despite the hundreds of thousands of Soviet soldiers, diplomats, journalists and political advisors who passed through it, they were thrown into a country where bribery, corruption, profiteering and drugs were no less common than the long lines in Soviet stores. These diseases can be far more infectious and dangerous than hepatitis, particularly when they reach epidemic proportions."
A Russian movie scene. On a subway, a deranged veteran in a wheelchair is shouting, "Don't stop shooting! Don't stop! Fall in! No, fall out! We're going to fry their village! Why don't you shut up? We're your boys, stupid! We've brought back Mujahideen ghosts!"
Borovik said that the Russians resembled the astronauts in a famous Soviet science fiction film called Solaris. The astronauts find a planet covered with a giant ocean that seems to be conscious. And to try and influence the ocean, they bombard it with X-rays. What they don't realize is that the ocean is irradiating them. It is playing back in the astronauts' minds memories of the past, but in such a vivid way that they begin not to trust anything that they think or believe. Afghanistan, Borovik said, was doing the same to the Russians. It had led them to distrust the very basis of everything they believed in, and they were taking that distrust back with them into the heart of Russia.
In Afghanistan, British combat troops are emerging from a plain, rifles in hand, and spreading out in a field. The scene shifts. Dozens of Afghan men, their faces partly covered, glare at a BBC reporter and cameraman. One man shouts at the reporter. We say to the British here, it is not the Taliban who are fighting you. If you don't know this, take a look at your history. It is the Afghan land which is fighting against you. Because you Britishers have come back, the Afghans have all got angry. We will defeat you once again, the way we did before. See all these men? They are Taliban. But they haven't come from abroad. They are Mujahideen, who will take the Britishers out of our country. And if all Afghans die, the soil of Afghanistan will haunt you and destroy all of you.
The massive increase in the price of oil imposed by the Saudis had caused economic and social chaos in the West. Governments had struggled to deal with it, but they had failed. And in the 1980s, right-wing governments came to power in Britain and America, who turned to radical new ways to create economic growth. To begin with, the new policies seemed to work. Inflation was squeezed out of the system, and the economies began to stabilize. But then, there were other unexpected consequences. Interest rates had risen massively, and this decimated manufacturing industry in both Britain and America. Factory after factory closed. High-paid skilled jobs were replaced by low-wage jobs in the service industries. And living standards began to fall. But then, the politicians found a solution. If you couldn't make wages grow any longer, instead, you would get the banks to lend people money. And in the mid-1980s, governments removed the restrictions on the banks' lending, and a wave of borrowing spread through Britain and America. Even if their wages were static, people felt wealthier and had the money to buy things and to keep the economy working. And the power to manage society began to move even more from politics to the financial system. But there was one industry in Britain that had survived, and in fact was growing. It was the arms industry and its vast trade with Saudi Arabia. But rather than strengthening the politicians' power, it undermined it further through corruption. Through the 1970s, British arms companies had signed more and more contracts with the Saudis, and they became a central part of a new industry that was run from the very heart of the British government.
We're in the Ministry of Defence in Whitehall. Behind these doors, there's a room which few people, apart from Arab sheikhs and other potential foreign customers, have ever set eyes on before.
This way, please.
This is it, the Permanent Defence Equipment Exhibition, the supermarket of the sales organisation which this year will sell nearly £600 million worth of British military hardware to foreign governments.
By the 1980s, the giant orders from Saudi Arabia had become essential to Britain. While much of British industry had closed, the arms business kept growing.
From air to ground. No, I'm a prime minister. I have to say the super saleswoman do their job.
And in 1985, Mrs. Thatcher announced what was going to be the biggest arms deal in history.
The extraordinary arms deal, which has impressed military experts throughout the world. It emerged today that Britain and Saudi Arabia have signed what's thought to be one of the world's biggest arms agreements. The deal will mean Saudi Arabia will get many more combat planes, training aircraft, new mine hunters, two new air bases, and much training and support. It means Britain is pulling level with, if not overtaking, the United States as the biggest military supplier to the Saudis.
The Al Yamama deal was presented as a triumph of British ingenuity and skill. But ever since,
there have been allegations that really it was secured by vast bribes to key members of the Saudi establishment. British Aerospace admit that there were payments, but insist they were not bribes. But then, in 1990, it became clear that all the arms trade with Saudi Arabia had been a complete charade. Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and the leaders of Saudi Arabia realized that despite all this hardware, all the planes, the missiles, the bombs, and the radar systems, that their country was incapable of using it properly to defend itself against Saddam Hussein. So they had to turn to America and its military might for help.
President George Herbert Walker Bush.
At my direction, elements of the 82nd Airborne Division, as well as key units of the United States Air Force, are arriving today to take up defensive positions in Saudi Arabia. I took this action to assist the Saudi Arabian government in the defense of its homeland.
Osama bin Laden had returned from Afghanistan, and he went to see the Saudi defense minister and pleaded with him not to let the Americans come. He offered to raise a force of Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan and bring them to defend Saudi Arabia instead. But the defense minister turned him down. And within weeks, over 500,000 American soldiers had arrived in Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden saw it as the corrupt takeover by the West of the very heart of Islam. And he decided that America, although it had been his ally in Afghanistan, was the real enemy.
My Wand, Afghanistan, 2007. Troops find themselves traveling across the site of an ancient battlefield. In 1880, men of the Alatsai tribe from northern Helmand killed nearly 1,000 British soldiers at My Wand. The British were overwhelmingly defeated.
When the Russians left Afghanistan, the different Mujahideen groups turned on each other and began a vicious struggle for power. Kabul was completely destroyed as the different groups fired thousands of rockets indiscriminately into the heart of the city. And Kabul became a living hell. The Mujahideen leaders transformed. They became brutal warlords, tearing the country apart. The Americans had stopped sending any money or arms, so to fund themselves, the warlords turned to the heroin trade, and they began to export more and more opium to the West. The poppy fields of Helmand became the center of a multi-million dollar business, irrigated by the dams and canals built 40 years before by the American government. Out of the chaos came two extreme and violent reactions. Both ruthlessly simplified the world, and both, although they were completely contradictory, were rooted in Wahhabism, the intolerant fundamentalism that came from Saudi Arabia. One was the Taliban. They started as a group of students in religious schools in Pakistan called madrasas, where many Afghan children had gone to study. They became the core of a revolution that spread rapidly through Afghanistan. Although they were in Pakistan, most of the madrasas had been created over the previous 20 years by money from Saudi Arabia. They were part of the massive effort that had been started by King Faisal to spread fundamentalism throughout the Islamic world. And the ideas that the madrasas taught were very close to Saudi Wahhabism. When the Taliban swept into Kabul, they went to the presidential palace and tore out all painted images of living things, even removing the faces off the stone lions. The society the Taliban built was based on an imagined idea of the past, a recreation of how they thought Islamic society had been run in the 7th century. All modernization was swept away.
Women were not to be educated, and all film and music was banned. And even the bodies of dead communists were dug up and burnt to cleanse and purify the land. The other reaction came from Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden had come back to Afghanistan, determined to lead an Islamist revolution. But his ideas were very different from the Taliban. He wanted to use Islamic principles in a new way, to make it a revolutionary force in the modern world. To go forwards, not backwards. But the problem was that these ideas had failed to capture the public imagination, not just in Afghanistan, but throughout most of the Islamic world. Bin Laden was convinced that what was stopping this revolution was America. He had seen how American money had corrupted Saudi Arabia. Now he believed that America was corrupting the minds of Muslim people everywhere and preventing them from rising up and liberating themselves. Bin Laden's Islamist ideas began to mutate and become mixed with the intolerant and anti-modern anger of Wahhabism. Out of it came a dark and apocalyptic jihadism. It's said that the only way to create a revolution would be to attack what he called the far enemy directly. The dramatic shock would somehow liberate the masses. But all discussion of what kind of society would result dropped away and was replaced by a stark vision of the coming battle between good and evil. America and the coalition forces invaded Afghanistan not just to find those behind the attacks on America, but also to transform Afghanistan into a modern democracy. It was a grand plan, but the logic behind it was simple. If the innocent people of Afghanistan could be liberated from the evil forces that had terrorized them, then they would become free individuals. And out of that, a democracy, like those in the West, would grow naturally. Tens of thousands of Americans and Europeans would pass through the country over the next 10 years. Soldiers, diplomats, experts, political advisors, and journalists. All of them trying to build this new society. But few of them stopped to think whether what had happened to the Russians 20 years before might also happen to them. That in a strange way, Afghanistan has revealed to us the emptiness and hypocrisy of many of our beliefs. And that we may be returning from there, also haunted by Mujahideen ghosts. Knowing that underneath, we believe in nothing.
And on that nice little recap, we'll end this week's installment. Come back next week for the final portion. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and y'all come back now, here.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear originally aired in early 2015. But since the fraudulent global war on terror blazes on and the lies and propaganda continue, I thought it would be useful to air it again. Hopefully it'll give you a deeper understanding of what's really going on in the Middle East. So let's begin with this interview with Michael Springman. Today I'm joined on the show by former State Department diplomat and author Michael Springman to discuss his recently released book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View. Michael Springman was assigned to the U.S. Visa Office in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in the 1980s, which was heavy with CIA influence, and where he was repeatedly asked to issue visas to very questionable characters. When he questioned the practice and refused some of these visas, he was reassigned and eventually fired. After 9/11, he reported this situation to the FBI, some members of Congress, and several other government offices, but nobody wanted to listen. I met with Michael Springman when he was speaking at the Valley Forge 9/11 conference in, I think, 2011, called Treason in America. He's struggled over the years since 9/11 to make sense of why visas were being given to clearly unworthy characters. And this journey has led him to writing his new book called Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View. Michael Springman, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. I'm pleased and honored to be able to talk to your listeners.
Could you tell us a bit about your background and what led you to writing the book Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View?
Well, my background briefly is that I had worked for the federal government for something more than 20 years. I had worked initially for the Commerce Department's International Trade Administration and hadn't gotten trips overseas to Germany, to Stuttgart as an economic commercial officer, and then to India as a new foreign commercial service officer, as commercial attaché in the American Embassy in New Delhi. I eventually got into the real foreign service, and as a reward, I was sent to Saudi Arabia, to Jeddah on the West Coast, and later on to Stuttgart again as political economic officer. And then my last assignment was economic officer at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in Washington, D.C. Since then, after the State Department fired me, I went to law school, became an attorney, and do a little bit of everything from visas to family law to collections to essentially general practice.
So, Michael, I understand that ever since 9/11, you've been trying to get people to listen to your story. You've filed many FOIA requests, even went to court. You've written many letters to government agencies, but have gotten nowhere. And this led to your deciding to write the book. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I said, all right, I got enough here to put something together. And then I thought and looked at the news and said, you know, I sort of got the impression these guys were recruited as a cadre, because Joe Trento, the journalist, told me once I was out of the State Department and met him by chance that what they were doing was recruiting people for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. And I said, ah, that explains everything, but it doesn't explain why they were so secretive about this. This is years later. What have they got to hide? People know about this now. So I began thinking, you know, they got this cadre. And I saw what had been done to Iraq and to Yugoslavia and to Libya and what's going on in Syria now. And I said, well, you know, I think these guys were recruited and kept as a paramilitary army, if you will, a group of terrorists that they can be aimed at and turned loose on a country the United States didn't like. So I started doing research. And the more I looked, the more this came together. And I said, this is what they're hiding. I had one good contact who said, I don't know anything about this myself, but I think that you're getting the stonewall from these people because this is still going on. And Joe Trento told me pretty much the same thing. So I started looking, and I saw that these people all had training in Afghanistan. They had been trained in Bosnia. I found out that besides running these people through Jeddah, like Joe Trento told me, there were 52 recruiting offices in the United States, including one in Washington, D.C., but no more information than that. I think that's probably the subject of another book, if I can ever nail some of this stuff down. And as this went on, I began looking for people to talk to because I felt, you know, saying this and proving it are two different things.
To gather information for the book concerning this cadre of militants being trained by the U.S., Michael Springman contacted many knowledgeable people concerning the Middle East who were not U.S. government supporters, but even they wouldn't talk to him.
Why do you suppose this is that none of these people would talk?
Well, it's everything from not really knowing who I am to being concerned about their name would be in print and it might do something to their chances for another job or advancement somewhere. Or they may have been told by government officials not to talk about this. They were certainly well-connected enough to know what was really going on and didn't want their names on the dotted line anyplace. And then some Arabs have told me that people from the region don't really want to help anybody unless they see some advantage in it for themselves. So it could be one or the other, or maybe even all of the reasons I've just named. So I eventually found enough information off of various websites, the Wayne Madsen Report, Michelle Chossudovsky's Global Research up in Canada, the Washington Post, New York Times, a couple of European newspapers like The Guardian and some others. And I began to put this stuff together and try to draw a clear pattern and a clear line of time and action from what happened in Afghanistan to what happened in Yugoslavia and to Iraq to Libya and to Syria. And I found that a lot of the people were basically fanatical Muslims that the American government had recruited. And Cheryl Bernard, who is the wife of Zalmay Khalilzad, the Afghan-American who was ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, and the United Nations, she said there was no way of getting the Soviets out of Afghanistan unless we get the wildest, craziest, most vicious people going to fight them. And from what I could see of the recruitment from various groups that fought in the countries I've just named, they were all wild-eyed, over-the-edge Muslim radicals, many of whom were Arab, and they had Soviet money behind them. They had the assistance of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence, which helped the Saudis in training and recruitment and organization. And the American CIA and the Israeli Mossad were also in there working with these people. And I managed to get a phone conversation with Bob Baer, the former CIA case officer. He said this was done for plausible deniability. They wanted to keep this secret and didn't want to tell the wild men they were recruiting that the United States of America was really behind it all, or the Israelis for that matter. And they all thought that they somehow found their own way to Afghanistan and Yugoslavia and the other countries through watching it on TV or getting it off the Internet or something like this, which sounds totally bizarre to me.
So people were coming then through the office where you were at in Saudi Arabia, getting visas where they didn't really qualify, but getting visas to come to the U.S. to be trained here?
Yeah, right. They were sent to the CIA training facility near Williamsburg that's called The Farm, and to various military bases in North Carolina, and many involved with SEAL training.
And these guys became Al-Qaeda, what we know as Al-Qaeda?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a brand name. They were Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Then it became Al-Qaeda when Osama bin Laden and a lot of the people from Afghanistan went to the Balkans to overthrow the Serbian government.
And how about ISIS today? Are they just the next progression of this?
Yeah, another brand change. You can't keep fighting the same group over and over because people wonder why they haven't been destroyed with American air power and American money and so forth. So it's basically the same crowd, same fanatical Muslims, same Arab countries, either sending them as recruits or financing like Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states.
And now you call this, in your book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, you call this foreign policy a train wreck. And you say that the origins of this come from under President Truman in 1947 when he created the NSA and the CIA.
Exactly.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Back in the 1940s, people had the idea that if they had a decent intelligence service, instead of a catch-as-catch-can group of military service intelligence agencies, they wouldn't have another Pearl Harbor. And they created the Central Intelligence Agency in the late 1940s, and they created the National Security Agency at the same time. And Truman initially didn't like the idea. And he thought, well, maybe this would become an American Gestapo, German secret police under the Nazis. He thought that this was not something the United States should be doing. And the Secretary of State, a military man, Marshall, also told Truman this is not a good thing to do. These people are taking away the function and the control of the State Department and the Armed Forces, the War Department, away from civilian control and putting this into some kind of mysterious underground organization that may or not be controlled. Certainly Nazi Germany, Hitler couldn't even control his domestic intelligence service. He had wanted American prisoners of war killed, and German counterintelligence service said, no, we're not going to do it, and successfully hid them and successfully dodged Hitler's direct orders.
Similar to that, here you say that the CIA and the NSA operate without executive, legislative, or judicial control.
Exactly.
And you say that in the book also that the CIA is deeply connected to domestic law enforcement, which is illegal under the laws of their creation. And you say they do this through the fusion centers. Could you address that?
Right. Well, the fusion centers were set up after September 11th to get more information and to watch more people. And it was a connection of not only the CIA and the NSA and the FBI, but local police forces. You had joint terrorism task forces set up. And they've gotten to the point now where they've been given a mandate by the president to go and investigate just about anybody they find suspicious, and they go and they collect all the records they can possibly find for them, either in the American government or out of it.
You also have a section in the book about Osama bin Laden. Could you tell us about his connection to the CIA and who he worked for?
Well, he was recruited by the CIA to help with the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. He used his father's connections. His father and the bin Ladens, the whole family, had a lot of businesses in Saudi Arabia. They sold everything from cars to construction equipment to actual construction, where they would build buildings and dig holes and things like this. And he got a lot of this stuff moved to Afghanistan, and using the expertise they had in the companies to make fortresses and underground bunkers they could use to fight the Soviets. And, of course, he was trained and given a lot of advice from the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah, and what do you know about his involvement or lack of it on 9/11?
Well, I don't rightly know, because the Americans blame him for it. But then, on the other hand, I've seen things that said that Osama bin Laden has been charged with many things, but never masterminding the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon.
Right, right. This FBI has said they have no evidence linking him to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand his CIA name was Tim Osman.
That I don't know. I do know that this guy, John Schindler, who wrote a book called Unholy Terror about the recruitment of fanatics for the Yugoslav War. Schindler is a right-wing neocon type. He's a former NSA analyst. And he says flatly that a lot of the people involved in 9/11 were involved with this, what I call the Arab-Afghan region, the people who came out of Afghanistan as well-trained Mujahideen terrorists, and they worked to overthrow the government of Yugoslavia. And a lot of these people were involved in that, and they were also involved in planning the September 11th issues.
Well, that's really curious to me, because if Schindler is a neocon, as you say, there's lots of evidence that the neocons were the ones who actually orchestrated 9/11. So it would make sense that Schindler would want to point the finger at the Muslims and away from the neocons. Even the efforts in Congress to release the 28 redacted pages of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 seems to be an attempt to throw the Saudis under the bus and divert attention away from the real perpetrators.
But that's another show, I guess. Let me ask you, during the whole Yugoslavia mess that happened back in the 90s, I guess it was, I was not very political, and I believed whatever the government was telling me. And so, but now I've watched the movie Weight of Chains about that. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't.
It's a very good movie about what we did to break up Yugoslavia. But you mentioned that in your book. So we took these people who got illegal visas through the Jeddah office and perhaps elsewhere. And I know you have a chapter in your book about this. Could you just talk about that briefly?
Sure. A lot of these guys were moved into Yugoslavia. They had the services office, the Maktab al-Khidmat in New York City, in the Al-Farouk Mosque, in the Al-Kifa Center. They worked to train and recruit people for the Afghan War, and they also worked to overthrow the government of Yugoslavia. They had established an office in Bosnia, and they fed money and people into that. And there were mysterious flights of airplanes into Yugoslavia, what was then Yugoslavia, with fighter escorts. And when people asked questions about it, there was one guy, Ivan Moldestad, who was a captain in the Norwegian Air Force, who flew helicopters. He said, you know, what's going on? I saw these airplanes come in, and he called NATO offices in Vicenza, Italy, that handled a lot of the air traffic, and said, this is what I saw. And they said, no, you didn't, and hung up on him. He was taken up to the fifth floor of a hotel balcony by some American officers and said that you really shouldn't be doing this because things can happen to you. But money and weapons and fighters poured into Yugoslavia from all over, masterminded by the CIA, working with the Iranians, of all things. At one point, they were flying plane loads of weapons and things using Iranian transport aircraft. Additionally, they had close connections to all of the European intelligence services. The Germans, for example, one of the people who supposedly was a mediator was really head of the German External Intelligence Service, the Bundesnachrichtendienst. And the Germans were shipping weapons into Yugoslavia for use by people fighting the government, the Arab Afghans, in packages labeled humanitarian aid supplies. So it was a collection of really bad people who were given NATO intelligence, who were given training, and who were helped in setting up a lot of these what you call false flag exercises, where supposedly the Muslims were attacked in a massacre by Serbian forces when it actually was the other way around. The Muslims set up an explosion and blamed it on the Serbs.
So they used these false flag operations to destabilize the country, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Just as had been done, for example, in Italy in the 70s and 80s, where people were going around blowing up train stations, saying, you know, these are left-wing communist agitators, when in fact it was the Italian security services backed by the Americans doing it.
Yeah, that's Operation Gladio you're referring
yep.
to?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're saying these same people that were used as Al-Qaeda have been transported from Yugoslavia, then they were taken to Libya, Syria, and I think Iraq also?
Yeah, right. They went to Iraq after Yugoslavia, but I'm inclined to think that they're still working in Iraq.
Yeah.
But in Libya, for example, this guy, Belhaj, who is part of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, he was a member of Al-Qaeda, and he worked to overthrow the government of Muammar Gaddafi. And suddenly, in a country that had the highest measure of any kind of standard of living in all of Africa, you had fantastic amounts of arms and terrorists flooding into the country, and nobody asked, well, where they came from or why they were flooding into Libya all of a sudden. But he was running a government that really questioned what the United States was doing, questioned what the British were doing, and questioned and lectured American government officials like Tom Lantosh, the congressman who was firmly in the pockets of the Israeli government, saying, look, you're bringing terrorists into the country, and we're trying to shift them back to where they came from as fast as we can catch them. Why don't you people do something about it? And this automatically put him on the outs with the American government. And when Obama was elected president, he reversed any kind of help that the Bush family had put together for aid and things for Libya. And he simply froze Gaddafi out of everything. He wouldn't meet with him at a summit in Italy. He wouldn't meet with him when he was invited to celebrate the anniversary of the revolution that overthrew the king. And, you know, at the time, Gaddafi was pretty much beating these terrorists that were imported by the British and the Americans and the Europeans and everybody else, and had driven them into the eastern section of the country, and it was a couple weeks away from ending the whole mess when the Americans sent NATO in to bomb the living hell out of the place. And then they began shipping the weapons that had been collected in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi to Syria. They were sent out in 600-ton batches by shiploads, sometimes to Turkey, sometimes overland, sometimes flown by Saudi and Air Jordan aircraft into Turkey and into Syria, with the help of Jordan, who provided bases to train a lot of these people to fight Bashar al-Assad. You know, he may not be the world's best leader, but he certainly didn't destroy the country like what's happening now. This came from outside sources.
Yeah, and so you're saying that a lot of the foreign intelligence agencies work with our CIA to carry this out, these operations out around the world.
Yeah.
In the book, you also mentioned that they work together to do sort of psychological operations online by going to blogs and websites and trying to disrupt mm-hmm. things. Could you talk
sure.
a bit about that?
Well, they do that. I mean, I've seen what they've done to me and what they've done to the investigative journalist Wayne Madsen. They have a Wikipedia article, for example, on the Internet that essentially says he doesn't know what he's talking about and he has a sketchy background and this, that, and the other thing. And in my case, they put up like two sentences at one point years ago. It didn't really say much more than I had been critical of the State Department for authorizing visas for rather sketchy people. And now that I've written and spoken out more on this, they've added a few more sentences to talk about, well, you know, he really didn't know anything because the State Department said a consular officer has the final approval on a visa application, neglecting the fact that I was indeed a consular officer.
So all of this foreign policy with all of these wars that are being orchestrated by the CIA and their intelligence community friends around mm-hmm. the world, how do they pay for this? I mean, this is costing a fortune. How do they pay for all of this?
Well, it's American money. The CIA has a budget that nobody knows how big it is. Their budget comes from appropriations given to other agencies. For example, the National Security Agency is part of the Defense Department, and they get a big chunk of money there. So you never know how much money goes for arms and ammunition or for the army in Germany. It really ends up in Fort Meade in Maryland, where NSA is headquartered. Additionally, the Saudis are putting a lot of money into this, as well as the Gulf states, especially Qatar. In addition, some of the groups that are fighting the government, any government almost, like IS or ISIL, Adil Shamu, who's an Iraqi-American, was speaking at the Palestine Center one day and said that, you know, these guys are also getting money because they were selling oil for $25 a barrel when the going rate for oil from Saudi Arabia or anywhere else was $100 a barrel. So they're making money that way as well.
And also, I mean, it's coming from the U.S. Treasury, so we don't have money for health care and for all these other things, but we have all this billions and trillions for these wars.
Yeah.
Okay, now, the media in our country is supposed to be investigative and checking power, right, executive power. Mm-hmm. And you talk in the book about Operation Mockingbird and how they're not doing their job. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Sure. Well, Operation Mockingbird goes back to the 1950s. When the CIA set up an arrangement with a number of prominent journalists like Walter Pincus, who's still with the Washington Post, and Bed Bradley, who was with Newsweek at the time, who then became editor of the Washington Post later on, they basically got them to plant stories, they got them to slant stories. They were basically the propaganda arm of the CIA. They wanted to slant something a certain way, and they got it done.
How pervasive do you think it is to have sort of CIA agents working in the mainstream media?
It's outrageous, and the mainstream media is basically a bunch of corporate shills for government and for their sponsors that pay them money, and they don't want to rock the boat. Bob Perry, the journalist, had a book out a number of years ago whose name escapes me at the moment, but in the book, Perry had talked about his experience breaking the news on Iran-Contra when he started writing about a plane that was shot down, and suddenly there was an American guy who had been in the army in it, and the plane was full of weapons. And he did the basics for leaking the story that the CIA was trying to overthrow the Sandinista government of Nicaragua. And lo and behold, he lost his job with Newsweek. And then he had trouble getting a job in the mainstream media. He started writing on the side. He'd gotten the job with Bloomberg News, and he's running a website and writing books at the moment. But he went into great detail about how the news media worked for the government and for the corporate sponsors. He talked about a meeting one time he had had at Newsweek with higher-ups in the company and with people from the American government. And they said, well, you know, we want you to change the focus of your story, and then we think that saying it this way makes it really look bad, and if you put it another way, then things look a lot better. And he said, I'm a journalist. My job is to tell the truth without any shade of color or varnishing it to make it look shiny and new and hide the warts.
You say in the book that as a career official in both the Commerce and State Departments, you saw these plots close up, these plots around the world. And if you saw them, would you say that many others that work in the federal government saw them too? And if so, why aren't they saying something?
Well, I would think they did see this. I make a point in the book. One thing I'd like to follow up on sometime is that if I could see all these questionable visa applicants coming to me, what about the experienced immigration officers at the port of entry? Couldn't they see that these guys really had no ties to their country or place of application? And why was suddenly a clerk in a grocery store wanting to go to the Grand Canyon or to go to the West Coast or something like this? Or the guys that couldn't name the trade show on automotive parts and accessories, or where it was being held. Couldn't they see this? Now, I think they were either told to shut up, or they felt that this looks like trouble, and it's not good for my career if I blow the whistle, because people who blow the whistle become unemployed and unemployable.
Right, and I know you've had that experience firsthand.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me, with what's happening between the U.S. and Russia, we seem to be very aggressive toward Russia, baiting them, making them look bad in the media. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of your experience?
Sure. From what I've seen, the Americans are deeply involved with overthrowing governments, you know, these color-coded revolutions that John Kerry seems to be denying now. But in the case of the Ukraine, they were involved in this Orange Revolution that pushed out a pro-Soviet or pro-Russian leader and replaced him with somebody who was more tied to the U.S., who had been educated in the U.S. and were horrified when they were bidding to encircle Russia by splitting Ukraine away from it. There's a sort of a natural tension between the Ukraine and Russia, because Joe Stalin had controlled the country very restrictively and killed a lot of people. But in the case of Ukraine in the present day, they overthrew the government, they forced out the leader, sent him packing to Russia, and they said, well, he was trying to engineer a deal with Russia that was better than the deal we had with Europe. And the deal with Europe was basically going to bring in a wave of unemployment and a wave of cost-cutting, which would make life miserable for the people in the country. And as long as they can weaken countries around the Soviet Union or Russia today, as they've done in the past, they keep advancing NATO, for example, up to the edge of the Russian border, and they have American troops at the Russian border, and they're sending American troops into the Ukraine. But the whole idea is to get regime change in Russia and find a leader more amenable to capitalism in the United States and to provide outlets for American goods and services and to, again, crush the economy of Russia.
So it's the same plan all
over again. Yeah, they're getting more successful at it. They did it in Yugoslavia and these other places. In the Arab world, they have the Arab-Afghan Legion. In Ukraine, they don't seem to have anybody more organized than Pussy Riot. But they're still destabilizing the place. They've rounded up a bunch of neo-Nazis, apparently, from their flags and the statements they've made to fight on behalf of the illegitimate government in Kiev, and are horrified that the people in the East are Russian-speaking and feel more of an affinity with Russia than they do with a bunch of neo-Nazis out of Kiev.
You've just been listening to the first part of an interview with former State Department diplomat and author Michael Springman. His new book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View, was recently released. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of this interview. And again, you are just listening to a rebroadcast of the first part of an interview with author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman. And now here's an interesting news item. Apparently, the Department of Defense has been assisting movies. Shortly after World War II, the U.S. Department of Defense began formally involving themselves in Hollywood. Since then, they've been involved in hundreds of productions. But until now, we didn't know exactly how many or precisely which films did or did not bear the touch of the Department of Defense. But in response to a recent FOIA request, the DOD provided a list, and it included The Perfect Storm, The Jackal, What Price Glory, to name just a few. They've also been involved in TV programs, and American Idol is one of them. To learn more about this, you can go to the website spyculture.com, where you can have access to the 1,400-page military document, including all of this information. And again, the website is spyculture.com. 9/11 Wake Up Call is produced at the University of Hartford, WWUH 91.3 FM, and airs Wednesdays at noon and again at 8 p.m. It also airs on WESU at Wesleyan University in Middletown on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. And the shows are archived at radioforall.net. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg.
Now the People's Summit, a way forward for people's power.
So you couldn't attend the People's Summit. Well, that's why we're providing a report back on the historic convening of organizations and individuals committed to social, racial, and economic justice. 3,000 people gathered in Chicago committed to a people's agenda that can enhance and expand issues, campaigns, and hold all elected officials accountable to popular demands for justice, equality, and freedom.
Later on, we'll talk with Winnie Wong, founder of People for Bernie and an organizer for the People's Summit. But first up will be Roseanne DeMauro, executive director of the National Nurses United, a major convener of the People's Summit.
The summit envisioned a deepening relationship between participating organizations rooted in principled anti-corporate politics and development of community leaders and direct action not based on partisan identification and strategic organizing to build power. That is a heck of an agenda. So tell us the inspiration, Roseanne, for putting this together. What was the glue that kind of bound all of these numerous messages and disparate groups? And thanks for putting together this phenomenal weekend experience.
Thank you so much for having me on. The nurses organization knew that when we got to the end of the primaries, we knew, you know, we had come off of some really kind of major movements, right? So you had Occupy, the climate marches, obviously, the labor frustration and all the hits there with trade, immigration rights, the litany goes on. And if I miss anyone, oh, LGBT, I mean, just the movements were there, right? And so the question is, how do you adhere these movements to actually have an agenda for the next administration? Bernie Sanders actually, all the press believes this, but it actually wasn't the case. It was not initially thought of by us. However, there was no one in history that could have brought all of these issues to light. Never seen anything like it than Bernie, and then the subsequent frustrations and deceptions. And it was just, you know, it all bubbled up. And so the magnitude of which we would plan this was far greater because of the Sanders campaign and the corruption of the DNC. I mean, it came together like magic. And I think there was a lot of residual sadness about the fact that, once again, the sector of Wall Street, if you will, had basically taken our voice away in denying Bernie Sanders, you know, to the various dirty tricks and kind of machinations of the press and everything that they did to deny Bernie the opportunity to go as a contender, even though he still can be, to the convention. So people were somewhat, I wouldn't say demoralized, but I would say sad. And I think that was kind of evident on Friday night. I could feel it was kind of palpable, and people gave voice to that and expressed that. But by the time we got into Saturday, it was just the entire 3,000 people, over 3,000 people, actually. And it shifted into planning and figuring out, you know, ways to agitate and ways to connect and ways to pathway forward to the future. And it was everywhere. And so there was no, since we were the major convener of this, I can say honestly, because I know, there was no political framework that we were going to put on in terms of expectations. We wanted people to kind of come together. And we knew that there could be an environment free of jargon, free of agitation, but where people could come and talk about their political concerns there, that we had the idea of building something. And it was beyond anything I've experienced in terms of who was that. They were hurting because of what happened to Bernie. It was just this culmination of frustration that turned to energy. The bandwidth of that meeting was enormous. So there was 100 million impressions on social media, and that does not include Facebook. Over 100 million impressions. People were following this, you know, in Japan. People were following this internationally. Obviously, I'm sure the Clinton people were following it. But it was what was needed. And in terms of Bernie, you know, if we would have asked Bernie to Skype in, I'm sure that he would have done that. But I think that we just took off in our own kind of the movement. It just gelled. I mean, it gelled in the workshops. And the other thing is just, so the program was, just in a nutshell here, so we had plenaries, And then we had breakout workshops, and they range from, Robin Hood tax to taking on Krugman to democracy CD training. They were overflowing. They were packed, and they were pitched at a very high level in terms of political education. They were so well attended. And then following that, and the plenary speakers, and then these stories from just of everyday people talking about their struggles. So we had a plenary with those throughout the session, so people could connect up their own struggles with other people. And then we had this talent from the film industry and from musicians who volunteered their time to come and perform. And it was extremely moving.
Roseanne, I wanted to bring this forward so that we can talk about what the next step is in the Democratic Convention and perhaps floor fights over the agenda there and over the platform and what happens after that.
Right, right. I think that's really important. Well, the first thing is, what's clear in terms of kind of following I get to follow closely, obviously, because of the position I'm in. But what's going to happen there is that they're going to use a lot of progressive legislators to try to chill the group out on their issues. I mean, that's coming. And I think they've completely underestimated this movement. I mean, the people who stayed with Bernie, I think a lot of people went to Bernie because their organization, on an organizational level, because they were forced to. I don't think that was easy because everyone assumed at the kind of the structural level of organizations that the country wasn't ready for the message that Bernie was speaking. And Bernie got out there and it was an implosion. He became an icon overnight, right? And so it actually was kind of in organizational terms, bottom up. The people of the organizations forced the organizations to endorse Bernie or to support Bernie. What's going to happen at the DNC, which I find this is the most critical point from my perspective, and then I'll talk about the actions, but the DNC is going to try to undo all of that. They're going to try to, at the convention, they're going to try to make people assume that everything's okay, that the DNC has control of everything. We hear your issues. It's going to be patronizing, and I think they've underestimated, from what I know about the base of Bernie and the base of our movements that predated Bernie, we're done with that message. We want to see action. We want to see single payer. We want to see workers' rights. We want to see climate change addressed in a profound way, not lip service. We want a Wall Street transaction tax. We want all of these things, obviously. And that's what a society is based upon. Our demands, and the Sanders demands weren't radical. I mean, a lot of the groups in the People's Summit think that it didn't go far enough, and I'm inclined to agree on some levels in terms of taking over the commons and all of that. I mean, our society, our country has been ripped away from us, and we really, I think the resonating voice is we want our country back, or we want our country. And so I think the DNC is going to be a lot of outside. I think thousands of people are going to come there. I know there's a CD action planned on the outside. I don't know about the inside yet. But we're going to try to force issues through and rules changes at the convention. The rules changes would be from opening up in terms of the horrors of what happened in New York, opening up the primaries for independents, to getting rid of superdelegates. And then on the platform side, which is non-binding, critical thing to remember because they can say anything and not do it, so we have to stay organized, try to get things addressed that are in all of the movements. I'd have to say they span all of the movements. And, that the committee is stacked against us and the convention stacked against us. We know that going in. So I don't think that we're assuming that the DNC is going to roll over. I do think, however, and I will say this because I get to interact with them in a variety of ways, but they are fearful of this movement. It is palpable. I had to address them the other day on single payer. I got to because Bernie insisted upon it because they kept me off the committee, which was quite a compliment.
Yeah, please
actually. Talk
a little bit more about that, the committee that you were kept off of.
That's the platform committee, right?
Well, pardon me? The drafting committee of the platform for the – yes. So there's 15 people who draft the basically the document that really matters there, I suspect. I know. So the DNC has five, Clinton has five or six, I believe. So there's more. And Bernie had five. He really wanted me on there because single payers is one of his threshold issues. The DNC told Bernie directly that, and Bernie talks about it, that they didn't want me on the committee because I was from labor. Now, if you want, just on if you want to know how badly the DNC has drifted from its origins, that statement in and of itself, that they thought that was a credible statement, says it all, that labor is not welcome. But in reality, it's me, because I'm uncompromising on our issues. I've got the luxury of working for the
nurses.
Can
I just interrupt to ask you, so you're suggesting or saying that there is no person from organized labor, much less the head of a major union such as yours, that is on the platform committee?
Oh, no. Actually, Clinton has someone in the platform committee. Paul Booth from AFSCME is on the platform committee. So that was deception, too. So ultimately, it was about single payer. So when it came to the meeting this week, the Bernie Sanders staff insisted that I testify. And it became extremely contentious. And I felt in that contention the power of this movement, because ultimately I thought what they were trying to do was to make me agree that the ACA had gone far enough. But other people listening thought that they were trying to get me to say that the Democrats work hard enough for us. And I wouldn't concede that point. Actually, it's online. You can listen to it. But I would not concede that point, and I will not concede that point, because ultimately our campaigns for the last so many years have been, we're not the Republicans, and that's good enough. And that's the campaign we find ourselves in right now with Trump, which is troubling. So none of our issues really... I believe that Bernie's going to go to the convention. He's going to fight, and we're going to be there with him. And I think all of the delegates are going to raise their voices inside, not including Bernie. But ultimately, the DNC isn't what matters. And that, it's another moment. It's another gathering for us and for the movement to basically continue to gel and move forward. I have zero expectations that the DNC is going to win anyone over, and zero expectations that they're going to do the right thing, because it conflicts with their major funders, which is, you know, Wall Street, basically.
Well, I'm afraid, Roseanne DeMora, we're going to have to leave it there with perhaps your last words at the conference, which were stay connected. We're building a new world. We have been speaking with Roseanne DeMora, Executive Director of National Nurses Union. We're going to hear a lot more about their activity. Thank you for the work that you've done, and we're going to stay closely connected. People for Bernie co-founder Winnie Wong, one of the former Occupy Wall Street activists who helped draft Bernie Sanders to run, founder of the online group People for Bernie, and who helped organize the summit alongside the National Nurses United, a frequent consultant as well within National Nurses United, now joins us. And Winnie Wong, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, Winnie, as a convener of the People's Summit, along with the National Nurses United, how do you assess the energy and aspirations that drew 3,000 people from across the country to Chicago?
Well, I think that the summit was a huge success. The space was populated with activists of all stripes who came together to discuss what's next, what's possible, what they've experienced over the past year, over the past, you know, decades. And everyone is filled with optimism, and we're ready to continue to organize in these next months toward justice.
A number of the participants that I've spoken to, and there have been many, suggested that after coming off of the bloody, painful experiences of the political violence with Orlando and the murder of legislator Joe Cox in Great Britain, that it was absolutely fitting that the summit had been convened by nurses, by caregivers, because people felt so bruised. The summit became, for many of them, a space for healing and hope, among other things.
That's right. The overall tone of the conference was extremely healing and cathartic and very process-oriented for folks, you know, many of whom have been in these fights for many years now. And also, it really illustrates how possible it is in American democracy that these spaces can exist. So, yes, it was wonderful for that.
Then I would certainly suggest that the summit was energizing. And the question becomes, what does the summit really energize people to do in its aftermath? I mean, participant Naomi Klein suggested it was very much the connective tissue of the movements that was what the conference was all about. Concretely, what does it stimulate people to do?
There wasn't just one conversation that emerged out of the conference. There were, you know, 1,000 conversations. for folks who are interested in, you know, continuing to organize in their communities or around their issue fights, those conversations were happening. For folks who are interested in answering Bernie's call to run for local office, those conversations were also happening. For folks who were interested in organizing to make sure that we show a strong force at the Democratic National Convention next month in Philadelphia, those conversations were happening. So there were really lots of conversations happening all at once in the space. And I think what's most important is that people are committed to organizing and they are going to continue to organize around the issues that they care most about.
Jeff Cohn, director of the Park Center for Independent Media, had emailed me that the campaign for Bernie was not a defeat, that it was not an end, but a kind of big acceleration of movements that existed pre-Feel the Burn, such as Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter and the Fight for 15, and that indeed it would lead to all sorts of progressive electoral interventions in the coming years. Is that your assessment?
I think one of the greatest successes of the Bernie Sanders campaign, as well as the movement behind it that we're, you know, working hard to expand, is that he managed to electrify a new generation of folks who to engage in the political process, right? So you have all these young people who are energized now and who are interested in electoral politics for the first time. That is very significant. It's also important to remember that he has managed to insert the ideology of democratic socialism into the mainstream. So this is also a huge achievement. If you think about it, prior to the Bernie Sanders campaign, the word socialism had not really been used so frequently, if at all, in the mainstream narrative. And now it's a word that people are not afraid of, that they don't flinch at. And the reality is over 12 million people elected a democratic socialist, and many more million people across this country are talking about it still, because it's not over yet. And so this is a huge achievement, and it would not have been possible if people hadn't organized to make this a reality. So, huge success.
Roseanne DeMauro, the executive director of National Nurses United, who provided substantial support for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, actually spoke to the Democratic Platform Committee recently, during which she advocated for a single-payer universal health care system in the United States. But she was really soundly lambasted by several of the members of the Platform Committee. She related the story when she spoke at the People's Summit. What role do you see for the Bernie supporters inside the upcoming Democratic National Convention, and particularly in influencing the planks in the platform? And of course, how does one essentialize which planks one is going to try to have a role in? For me, it's certainly single payer would be one fundamental one, but I'm interested in people who attended the summit and what their thoughts are within the context of the DNC.
Well, not having single payer healthcare in this country is cruel, frankly. We're the wealthiest country in the world, and we're one of the few countries that don't have single-payer healthcare. When you think about it, and Bernie makes this point in his stump speeches, when countries like China have single-payer healthcare and we don't, there's something really wrong with the system. So National Nurses United and Roseanne Morrow have been at the front of this fight for many years now, and right now we're at a moment where everyone in this country is talking about it. We have to do better than ACA, and we're going to continue to fight for it. And we're going to fight for it both inside and outside of the convention. So I know that the nurses have a delegation of almost 100 elected delegates. And what remains a fact is that, you know, millions of Americans across the country are without health care. And those who have health care, it's not enough. So those folks are going to be, you know, fighting for it as well. This isn't a sideline issue. This is a major issue.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Roseanne DeMauro had been proposed by Senator Sanders as a member of the Democratic Platform Drafting Committee, and she was vetoed by the Democratic National Committee on the pretext of restricting union voices in the DNC policy bodies. Actually, there's precisely one person from organized labor who's a Hillary person on the committee, and that is someone from AFSCME. So where this takes me, aside from the issue of universal health care, a single-payer system, is in what ways do People for Bernie and folks who came out of the summit see effectuating, whether it's a question of the rules that stacked the nomination towards Hillary Clinton, or whether it is the substantive issues to mobilize around? Is there a specific contemplated role on the floor in the DNC that people see to influence the process of trying to get progressive planks into the platform?
I think the other folks who have been elected to the drafting committee are all champions of single-payer health care, right? So, of course, they're going to be advocating for it inside. And I think, you know, all of the 1,900, you know, Bernie delegates who are going are all in support of single-payer health care. So their voices will be heard loud and clear. Personally, I think not including Roseanne in the drafting committee was a huge mistake and likely a deliberate decision, because she is the strongest and a very powerful voice behind this issue. And perhaps they are not ready to answer her call, which is really a call that millions of Americans are, you know, making now. But her not being included into the drafting committee doesn't at all mean that the folks on the outside and on the inside aren't going to fight for it and fight for it vocally. I mean, and also really beyond the convention, the fight for single-payer health care will continue. We are going to be working with National Nurses United for a very long time, and it's really a great honor to work with such a radical and progressive union. To have their support and their allyship has really been tremendous for movement organizers. What we saw this weekend is tested into that.
Now, it's been speculated that the Democratic National Committee plans to offer a concession to Senator Bernie Sanders, which are seats on a key convention platform committee. And even if that were to come to pass, would that be enough to stop Sanders from protesting various others of the party's policy positions? And to people who came out of these summit and People for Bernie want there to be a broader protest, both as to the rules and other positions to be raised at the Democratic National Committee convention and included in the planks?
Bernie will eventually make a decision, but his decision isn't necessarily one and the same of the decision of the people, right? So, I mean, I think this is a very important distinction. Folks are going to continue to organize and protest around the issues that they care about. And this is not going to stop. This is just going to grow stronger. And this is something that, like, the Democratic National Committee cannot control. Well-organized people win fights. And this is where we're at this moment in our movement. We're actually at a place where first-time organizers are starting to develop their chops and becoming, you know, more certain of the work that they're doing and also committing to this path of organizing. And of course, more seasoned organizers are at a moment in this movement where they are realizing what's possible and what this could look like if they choose to run for elected office or if they choose to take it to the next level. So this is really an important distinction. Of course, folks who attended the summit are going to fall in line behind Bernie, but it doesn't mean that they're going to stop organizing or protesting, you know, on the streets or not on the streets to fight for their issues that they care about. This isn't the end. It just means that protest becomes more organized and the social movement grows bigger, because politicians they must be held accountable by the people, and well-organized people constitutes a social movement.
Do you see any challenge to the leadership of Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz as part of what the efforts of People for Bernie, progressives who will be inside the hallowed halls of the convention? Is that something that's kind of been agenderized?
I think the call for the removal of Debbie Wasserman Schultz has really not been diminished at all. I mean, I think that there was a very loud and vocal call for her removal. There are several online petitions that are circulating that folks in the Bernie movement are behind and in support of. And I think that Tim Canova in Florida is continuing his campaign to beat her in the race. Even if she doesn't step down, I think she's demonstrated very poor leadership through this election season. And I think that the efforts to remove her will continue long after the convention is over. So she's not emerging out of this unscathed. It really just depends on how much of an organized effort there will be after the convention. I mean, she has demonstrated terrible leadership, and people won't forget this.
Did the People Summit influence or cohere around a specific strategy regarding the substance of the protest of those gathering outside of the restricted halls of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia?
Within the program, which I did put together along with a number of other folks in a planning committee, including Michael Whitey, who's the policy director of the union, we did include a direct action training led by the trainers from Democracy Spring, and it was very well attended. And I think the training itself was really designed to get folks to learn more broadly what direct action looks like, what nonviolent civil disobedience looks like. But it wasn't specifically a training created for the purposes of civil disobedience outside the DNC. It was more general. Direct action training was called Direct Action 101. It was very well attended. You know, we received a lot of national press around the training. I mean, I think it helped to have Rosario Dawson in the training. She led a chant. And so, yeah, I mean, nothing specific. There wasn't like, you know, a secret meeting of activists who are planning to take over the DNC. That did not happen, at least to my knowledge. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't everywhere.
Yeah, we should probably make note of that for police surveillance in any event.
I'm pretty sure, though, that folks who, you know, are planning on any kind of CD, a civil disobedience, are folks who are going to do so in a very, very, very peaceful way.
What you're clearly saying, though, is, you know, the people who feel the burn and the Bernie Sanders revolution, if you will, is not going to go gently into that good night. In fact, people are executing an intricate endgame to the Democratic primary and the 12 million voters who he inspired, you're certainly suggesting, have and will have a collective role to play post the convention?
Well, yes, because, you know, 12 million voters isn't the 130 million that voted in the last general. We have 80 million more voters to engage and activate. So, yes, I mean, to answer your question, yes, we have a lot of organizing to do and a lot of work to do.
I also want to ask you how important it is, in your opinion, that organized labor, that National Nurses United took a fundamental role, which is something we haven't seen very often in the past years, that organized labor comes into a people's summit to develop a progressive people's agenda and operates seemingly out of the bread and butter issues of their union structure to a much broader political role for labor.
The union is extremely progressive. Their nurses are always on strike, and there's a reason for it, because if you don't strike, you're not going to get what you need, really. And they have run very successful campaigns. You know, their Main Street campaign and Robinson tax campaign, and then their healthcare campaign have been very successful campaigns. And their organizers are some of the best organizers I've ever.
You know, Winnie, I just realized time is getting away from us. We're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Winnie Wong, who is with Bernie's for Sanders and one of the organizers of the People's. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
Pulse is a place where the international community really comes together. When I work the door, I see IDs from all over the world, and people just get there because they can be themselves.
Armed with a semi-automatic AR-15, he opened fire, indiscriminately shooting more than 100 patrons.
I can hear the shotguns closer, and I look over, and he shoots the girl next to me.
This attack occurred during the very month when we recognize and celebrate our LGBT brothers and sisters.
Love will always win underneath the skin. Everybody's got a pulse.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. In the headlines this week, Kenya's highest court legalizes gay anal probes, and Pride marches peacefully in Kiev and Seoul, but gets banned in Istanbul. Overshadowing those stories, however, was the horrendous carnage at a gay night spot in Orlando, Florida. We're devoting our entire program this week to coverage of the massacre at the Pulse.
Feel my pulse. Can't you see that I'm scarred? I'm just the same as you are, so just feel my pulse.
Today we're dealing with something that we never imagined and is unimaginable.
Orlando, Florida Mayor Buddy Dyer.
And it is with great sadness that I share we have 50 casualties. There are another 53 that are hospitalized.
An LGBT bar in Orlando, Florida, the Pulse, was the target of a homophobic ISIS-inspired attack in the wee hours of June 12th.
That tragic news was just breaking when This Way Out's Lucia Chappelle filed that report on last week's program. While the motives of the gunman remain elusive, much has come to light since then. As the world tries to comprehend the nightmare in Orlando, we've sampled some of this week's reports by Pacifica Radio News and Free Speech Radio News and added our own on-scene sound and some relevant music.
The world turned upside down. The world turned upside down.
Good evening. It's Monday, June 13th. From Pacifica Radio, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, this is the Evening News with Gabriela Castellan. I'm Mark Miracle. The White House and the FBI said today the gunman whose attack on a gay nightclub left 49 victims dead appears to have been a homegrown extremist who espoused support for a jumble of often conflicting Islamic radical groups. As Orlando mourned its dead with flowers, candles, and vigils, counterterrorism investigators dug into the background of 29-year-old Omar Mateen for clues to why the American-born Muslim carried out the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. FBI Director James Comey said Mateen was clearly radicalized, at least in part, via the Internet. The FBI chief also defended the Bureau's handling of Mateen during two previous investigations into his apparent terrorist sympathies, saying he didn't think there was anything the FBI should have done differently. More details of the bloodbath emerged, with Orlando Police Chief John Mina saying Mateen was cool and calm during phone calls with police negotiators. But the chief said he decided to send the SWAT team in and bash through a wall after Mateen holed up with hostages in a bathroom and began to talk about bombs and an explosive vest. The chief said he knew there would be an imminent loss of life.
We used our armored vehicle, the Bearcat armored vehicle, to punch a hole in that wall and defeat the wall. So there's a hole in the wall about 2 feet off the ground and about 2 or 3 feet wide. We were able to rescue dozens and dozens of people that came out of that hole. The suspect came out of that hole himself, armed with a handgun and a long gun, engaged in a gun battle with officers where he was ultimately killed.
Five of the some 50 wounded were reported in grave condition, meaning the death toll could rise. A call went out for blood donations. In Orlando, mourners piled bouquets around a makeshift memorial, and people broke down in tears and held their hands to their faces while passing through the growing collection of flowers, candles, and signs about a mile from the site of the massacre. The tragedy hit the city's gay and Latino communities especially hard. It was Latino night at the club when the attack occurred.
But if you go through that list of family members, we have a lot of individuals from Puerto Rico. We have a wonderful Puerto Rican community.
Florida Governor Rick Scott.
I have a young lady, KJ Morris, that just moved here from Hawaii to take care of mother and grandmother. I have an individual that Louis Velma that works at Harry Potter. I was just there last week. So you think these are people that we interact with every day of our lives.
Omar Mateen's father said his son recently got angry when he saw two men kissing in Miami. In brief remarks today, Sadiq Mateen, who is a U.S. citizen who immigrated from Afghanistan, said the entire family was shocked by his son Omar's actions.
We are all, my family is completely, we are shocked. They can't believe what did he do. My principle as a father, my principle as a U.S. citizen, I am against, I've been throughout my life against terrorism, against injustice, against what anyone can do against the United States.
For domestic violence advocates, though, there were some warning signs, like others who've gone on to carry out murderous acts. Mateen physically and emotionally abused his former wife, who spoke to reporters.
In the beginning, he was a normal being that cared about family, loved to joke, loved to have fun. But then a few months after we were married, I saw his instability, and I saw that he was bipolar and he would get mad out of nowhere. That's when I started worrying about my safety, and then after a few months, he started abusing me physically very often and not allowing me to speak to my family, keeping me hostage from them. And I tried to see the good in him even then, but my family was very tuned into what I was going through and decided to visit me and rescue me out of that situation.
That's the Orlando assailant, Omar Mateen's former wife. Nell Abram of Free Speech Radio News has more in this report from Tampa, Florida.
We are not afraid.
Hundreds of mourners gathered Sunday evening in Tampa's historic Ybor City to share their grief and express their anger after the massacre at the prominent Pulse Gay Club in nearby Orlando. Michael Martinez formerly worked security at the club and explains that it was much more than just a gay bar.
Pulse is a place where the international community really comes together, because you get people, you know, when I work the door, I see IDs from all over the country, all over the world, and people just get there because they can be themselves, they can be at ease. You didn't have altercations, you didn't have any problems. Everybody was accepting.
Gunman Omar Mateen entered Pulse about 2 a.m. Sunday morning. Armed with a semi-automatic AR-15 and a handgun, he opened fire, indiscriminately shooting more than 100 patrons. As people trapped inside frantically texted their loved ones and word of the massacre spread through social media, family and friends flocked to the scene. By the time the sun rose, anguished families, desperate for information, gathered at a nearby hospital.
Edward Sotomayor Jr., he was 24. Stanley Almodovar III, he was 23.
President Barack Obama addressed the nation just hours after the end of the siege, and again Monday morning, saying the U.S. has to grapple with combating organized terrorist groups overseas while also identifying homegrown extremists influenced by sexist and homophobic ideologies.
If we have self-radicalized individuals in this country, they are going to be very difficult oftentimes to find ahead of time. And how easy it is for them to obtain weapons is in some cases going to make a difference as to whether they're able to carry out attacks like this or not. And we make it very easy for individuals who are troubled or disturbed or want to engage in violent acts to get very powerful weapons very quickly. And that's a problem. It's a problem regardless of their motivations. It's a problem for a young man who can walk into a church and South Carolina and murder 9 people who offered to pray with him. It's a problem, you know, when an angry young man on a college campus decides to shoot people because he feels disrespected. It's certainly a problem when we have organizations like ISIL or Al-Qaeda who are actively trying to promote violence and are doing so very effectively over the internet.
People who knew Mateen have said he was both aggressive and homophobic. The FBI interviewed him 3 times since 2013 for allegedly making pro-extremist statements and after a member of his mosque carried out a suicide attack in Syria. FBI Director James Comey described the erratic allegiances claimed by the shooter during brief calls with 911 operators in the midst of the siege.
He said he was doing this for the leader of ISIL, who he named and pledged loyalty to, but he also appeared to claim solidarity with the perpetrators of the Boston Marathon bombing and solidarity with a Florida man who died as a suicide bomber in Syria for Al-Nusra Front, a group in conflict with the so-called Islamic State. The bombers at the Boston Marathon and the suicide bomber from Florida were not inspired by ISIL, which adds a little bit to the confusion about his motives. And of course, we're working to understand what role anti-gay bigotry may have played in motivating this attack, an attack that occurred during the very month when we recognize and celebrate our LGBT brothers and sisters.
Law enforcement held regular press briefings throughout the day Sunday, and politicians hastened to the microphones as well. Ashley Green is with the Tampa Bay Area Dream Defenders. She told the crowd at the Sunday vigil,
"I started to see Marco Rubio and Rick Scott and Pam Bondi, people who have literally threatened the safety of the very people at that club, get up and talk about mourning."
Green was referring to Florida's Republican senator, its governor, and the state attorney general.
"I want to know if they mourned when they fought for bathroom bills, when they fought against anti-bullying laws, when they fought against gay marriage, when they fought against people in the military, when they fought to get families deported, when they fought or got up and made a stump speech and a kid who was at that club that night had to hear some racial slur about going back to their country. Let's not forget that this was Latin night at Pulse. And the victims were the same people that they claim to mourn yet want to get out of the state of Florida."
As candles were lit at the Tampa vigil, silence fell over the crowd. After a few moments of quiet reflection under an exquisite Florida sunset, people quietly placed their candles around an improvised Pulse memorial set up on the sidewalk and slowly made their way back down the historic avenue.
Amen, amen, amen.
Nell Abram, FSRN, Tampa.
This is an attack on humanity itself.
Lady Gaga joined another one of the thousands of memorial vigils that encircled the globe, this one at the mouth of City Hall in Los Angeles.
"I hope you know that myself and so many are your allies. Millions of people around the world believe in you. You are not alone. You are not alone. Tonight, Orlando, we are united with you. And we are here to remember.
This is the Pacifica Evening News. With Mark Miracle, I'm Gabriela Castellan.
The two presumptive presidential nominees responded to the tragedy in Orlando. Democrat Hillary Clinton, speaking in Cleveland, said there was still a lot to learn about the killer.
"We know that he pledged allegiance to ISIS, that they are now taking credit, and that part of their strategy is to radicalize individuals and encourage attacks against the United States, even if they are not coordinated with ISIS leadership. But there's a lot we still don't know, including what other mix of motives drove him to kill."
Republican Donald Trump called for a suspension of immigration to the United States from countries which, in his words, had a proven history of terrorism against the West.
The killer, whose name I will not use or ever say, was born an Afghan of Afghan parents who immigrated to the United States. His father published support for the Afghan Taliban, a regime which murders those who don't share its radical views. And they murdered plenty. The father even said he was running for president of Afghanistan. The bottom line is that the only reason the killer was in America in the first place was because we allowed his family to come here. That is a fact, and it's a fact we need to talk about. We have a dysfunctional immigration system which does not permit us to know who we let into our country, and it does not permit us to protect our citizens properly.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Good evening. It's Tuesday, June 14th. This is the Pacifica Evening News. With Mark Miracle, I'm Gabriela Castellan.
President Obama today vehemently responded to presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump's proposal to suspend immigration from countries with a history of terrorism in response to the Orlando massacre. Rebecca Foster reports from Washington.
U.S. President Barack Obama blasted Donald Trump's plan to bar Muslims from immigrating to the U.S., calling it dangerous, sloppy, and un-American. He said proposals like Mr. Trump's are likely to increase the problem of radicalization by fueling the notion that the U.S. government is anti-Muslim. He said America was founded on the values of pluralism and freedom of religion.
And if we ever abandon those values, we would not only make it a lot easier to radicalize people here and around the world, but we would have betrayed the very things we are trying to protect. The pluralism and the openness, our rule of law, our civil liberties, the very things that make this country great, the very things that make us exceptional. And then the terrorists would have won. And we cannot let that happen. I will not let that happen.
Days after the deadliest mass shooting in recent U.S. history, patrons of the Pulse Club reported that 29-year-old Omar Mateen was a regular. That's raising questions about whether Mateen was conflicted about his own sexuality. Reporters spoke to several people about Mateen's presence at the Pulse. One person said he was trying to pick up men. Another said sometimes Mateen would sit in the corner and drink by himself. And other times he would get so drunk he was loud and belligerent. One man talked to the Orlando Sentinel about Mateen.
He was drinking with another guy at one time. A lot of it don't make sense, and we're never going to know.
Another said Mateen had messaged him on a gay dating app. The FBI became aware of Mateen in 2013 when co-workers reported that the private security guard claimed to have family connections to Al-Qaeda and to be a member of Hezbollah, too. Mateen was also quoted as saying he hoped law enforcement would raid his apartment and assault his wife and child so that he could martyr himself. The FBI launched a 10-month preliminary investigation following Mateen, reviewing his communications and questioning him. Mateen claimed he made the remarks in anger because co-workers were teasing him and discriminating against him as a Muslim, and the FBI eventually closed the case.
He's shooting everyone that's already dead on the floor, making sure they're dead.
26-year-old Angel Colon was trapped inside the Pulse nightclub while the shooting happened. He was shot multiple times in his leg, in his hand, and in his hip, and was trampled over by others trying to escape the club. Despite all this, he managed to survive. He described the horrifying ordeal.
I was able to peek over, and I can just see him shooting at everyone. And I can hear the shotguns closer, and I look over, and he shoots the girl next to me. And I'm just there laying down. I'm thinking, I'm next. I'm dead. So I don't know how, but by the glory of God, he shoots towards my head, but it hits my hand.
Rebecca Foster reporting.
This is a hate crime, plain and simple.
Niyad Awad, the National Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, repudiated the attack.
We condemn it in the strongest possible terms. It violates our principles as Americans and as Muslims. Let me be clear. We have no tolerance for extremism of any kind. We must not tolerate hateful rhetoric that incites violence against minorities.
Hey, are you sad that 50 pedophiles were killed today? No, I think that's great.
Sacramento Baptist preacher Roger Jimenez delivered a Sunday sermon hours after the attack on the Orlando nightclub, praising the massacre.
I think that helps society. You know, I think Orlando, Florida is a little safer tonight. I wish the government would round them all up, put them up against a firing wall, put a firing squad in front of them, and blow their brains out.
This is the Pacifica Evening News with Mark Miracle. I'm Gabriela Castellan.
When senseless acts of tragedy remind us that nothing here is promised, we live through times when hate and fear seem stronger. We rise and fall and light from dying embers, remembrances that hope and love last longer. And love is 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 love cannot be killed or swept aside. I sing Vanessa's symphony, Eliza tells her story. Now fill the world with music, love, and pride.
Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda paid tribute to the Orlando Pulse Massacre victims at the June 12th Tony Awards. This story continues to unfold. Authorities are now investigating the possible complicity of Martine's second wife, Noor Salman, in the attack. She initially cooperated with authorities, but her whereabouts are now not publicly known.
Love conquers hate!
More than 500 demonstrators held rainbow flags and signs that read Pride Over Prejudice outside the Verity Baptist Church of Sacramento preacher Roger Jimenez on June 19th. They came to condemn his celebration of the Orlando massacre during last Sunday's sermon. Jimenez has refused to recant, telling reporters this week that God has put a death sentence on LGBT people. Meanwhile, a handful of Democrats stormed out of the House of Representatives as yet another moment of silence was held in the chamber to honor the latest victims of gun violence. They were protesting their Republican colleagues' failure to grapple with gun control issues beyond such empty tributes to the dead. As for his motives, did Omar Martine explode at the intersections of jihadist zeal, mental illness, and a lethally conflicted closet? Sadly, as that Pulse regular observed,
we're never going to know.
Everybody's got a pain inside. Imaginary wounds they fight to hide. How can I hate them? Everybody's got a pulse. I dream in a world that wants my soul. It tells me if I hate, I can control. But I don't believe it. I cannot conceive it. 'Cause everybody's got a pulse. I am human. I am love. My heart beats with my blood. Love will always win underneath the skin. Everybody's got a pulse. Once again I hang my head to cry. I can't find the reason why they died. We will find the answer blowing in the wind. That everybody's got a pulse. I am human, I am love, and my heart beats with my blood.
love will always win. Underneath the skin, everybody's got a pulse. Who you gonna hate now, when there's no one left but you? Who are you gonna gun down, if you can't kill the truth? That it's inside of us, it's inside our blood, it's inside our pulse. I am human, I am love, and my heart beats in my blood. Love will always win. Underneath the skin, everybody's got a pulse. Everybody's got a pulse. I am human. Everybody's got a pulse.
That was a This Way Out edit of Pulse by Melissa Etheridge. The Advocate reported that the full-length single is expected to go on sale soon, with proceeds benefiting the Sunshine State's biggest LGBT advocacy organization, Equality Florida. That group reported late this week that close to $6 million has been raised thus far for the families and survivors of the Orlando massacre. A press release noted that the vast majority came from a GoFundMe campaign that has drawn more than 110,000 contributors from across the world and pledges from corporate sponsors and grassroots fundraising efforts locally and globally. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. Thanks this week to our own Lucia Chappell and to Pacifica Radio's Mark Miracle, Gabrielle Castellone, and Rebecca Foster, and to Nell Abram of Free Speech Radio News. Some of the music you heard came from Hamilton and from out duo Eli Lieb and Brandon Shea's Pulse, also available on YouTube. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Alicia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WGOT Gainesville, Florida, KKRP Collington, Oklahoma, 7THE Hobart, Tasmania, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Marie Ekwe is one of the most fearless American radicals you've never heard of. A contemporary of Emma Goldman and of working class origins, Ekwe was a doctor when few women were, and provided women with abortions and information about birth control when it was illegal. She was an anarchist, an opponent of militarism, ready to put her body on the line for her ideas. And she was an out lesbian at a time when the word didn't exist, adopting a child with her longtime lover. Because of all of these things, the state singled her out for particularly harsh repression. At the age of almost 50, she was sent to San Quentin under the Sedition Act of 1918 for her opposition to World War I. If she's not been completely lost to history, it may largely be due to the efforts of journalist and historian Michael Hellquist. He's the author of the first full-length biography of her, titled Marie Ekwe, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions, published by Oregon State University Press. And he joins me today. Michael, Marie Ekwe was born to an Italian father and an Irish mother in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Tell us about her origins and how she ended up in the West.
Well, so she was in this immigrant family in New Bedford, which is a very wealthy city. She was born in 1872, and this was a time when there were not many Italians in the country. This was sort of the first wave. And one of the defining factors of her childhood is that she felt her family was ostracized by the main community for being too Irish, and then by the Irish for being too Italian. So she felt, had this sense, she later said, of being an outsider. They were working class, a large family. Her mother gave birth to 11 children over 16 years. She was in the middle. And she was able to finish grade school, begin and complete 1 year of high school, and then her parents insisted that she drop out and work in the textile mills. And those days, New Bedford was a huge textile mill city. So she did that. She was an earnest and eager student, and she hated leaving, but she worked in the textile mills for 2 years, was miserable. And then a girlfriend of hers, a few years older, from a more well-off family, rescued her. And one of the things she did following year was to invite her to come to a homestead in Central Oregon with her. So this was Marie Ecuy's escape from the textile mills, because she knew there were no jobs suitable for her. She didn't want to get married. She knew from early on she didn't try to date or allow suitors to seek her company. And she knew she had no future there. So, and besides, she got to go out west and be with her girlfriend. So that was in 1892, these two women living together outside the small town of The Dalles, Oregon. And
tell listeners what you mean by a homestead.
Right. In the mid-1800s and then into the early 1900s, the government encouraged people from the Midwest and the East Coast to come out into the frontier west first early on and to stake a claim, which meant, depending on which program they were filing under, they could get 100 acres, say, or maybe 20 acres. And
so this is land which the native people have been dispossessed from.
Right. That had already occurred. And when Bessie Holcomb got her land, and let me back up, and the notion was that people would stay on the land, usually for a period of about 5 years, and then improve it, which was, and at the end of the 5 years, if they could show that they had done so, it was called proving up your claim, they were given title to the land. They were the owners. So Bessie Holcomb bought a title. It was already a few owners or generation removed from early Native Americans. And Marie Ecuy joined her. And then at some point, she decided she wanted to study medicine. This is someone with basically about a year and a half, 2 years of high school, because she took some extra schooling in Massachusetts.
And a woman.
And so not only didn't anyone encourage or expect women to become doctors, if they must have a profession, they were urged to be teachers or nurses. But she was also working class, which is really out of the ordinary. And Marie stepped above her station, in a sense, and she self-studied her way into medical school. They moved to San Francisco after their 5 years on the homestead. And she passed the entry exam, which was all that was required. She was fortunate at the time that a teaching certificate wasn't needed and a high school diploma wasn't needed. You just needed to pass the entry exam. So she did go to school for 2 years in San Francisco, two different medical colleges. The last one is now UCSF up on Parnassus Heights. She was there when there were only three buildings on Parnassus Heights in 1900. And then for some reason that we're not sure of, she relocated to Portland on her own. She was accompanied by another woman student who she was very close to. The relationship is a little uncertain, but she did leave San Francisco for Portland and complete her medical schooling there.
So she must have been in quite a minority as a female student in these medical programs.
She definitely was, although ironically, in her graduating class at the University of Oregon Medical Department, there were 10 students, 5 men and 5 women.
Hmm.
That just didn't happen very often.
And she then used her medical training in ways that were explicitly political. So I want to ask you, how did she become politicized and how did her politics shift in these early years?
Good question. And I'd only say partly from her background in New Bedford, she had an orientation to workers and to some strikes. She would say that her father brought strikers home to the family dinner. So she had some exposure to it. When she got established in Portland, she got involved with politics the way many professional women at the time did. It was progressive politics. This was in the early 1900s. Portland and Oregon were the center of progressive politics.
And progressive, are you meaning progressive as that term would be understood at that time or today? Perhaps you could define it.
Right. More so as it was understood then. It was definitely a sense of bringing more direct power to the people. So there are similarities. For instance, the initiative and referendum got started there, and people were working about that. They called it direct democracy. Some of the words were similar. Progressivism then did not suggest any more radical ideas as overthrowing the government, but working within the government for civic reform and social justice. So as many other professional women did, she got involved first with women's suffrage, which was determined state by state at that time. And it took Oregon 6 attempts to pass women's suffrage. She was involved in the last 2 campaigns, but her interests were broader than that. And you are right, she leveraged her professional position to push her causes, knowing that she was unusual, a woman doctor, people paid attention to her. And she took advantage of that. She also worked for things like an 8-hour workday with the state legislature, and funding for the state university, supporting progressive candidates. So she was on that track. It was more liberal than the norm, but from our view today, it was pretty mainstream also.
So how did she end up identifying as an anarchist?
It was an interesting occasion for her. Here she was, a doctor, and she was called out to help a patient on the east side of Portland, which was working class Portland, and this was in 1913. And she walked by a fruit cannery where women were picketing, women workers were picketing. Some of them were her patients, and they called her to join them and step up on the soapbox. And she did so, and with that step, she virtually changed her life because of the events that followed. And in the days ahead, the women were attacked by the police, and then the radical union group Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, got involved and supported the women, but also shifted it to a free speech fight in downtown Portland, and Equi joined that, and she got beaten by police, and she later said that she entered this strike as a socialist, but she came out of it as an anarchist, and she had this quote, "No man will tell me what to do." So it was a very personal thing, the radicalization. And you know, an interesting thing about Equi was that she was fluid in her politics. She was not an ideologue. She was not a theorist, necessarily. She wasn't an Emma Goldman, although she crossed paths with Emma Goldman and respected her. So sometimes I think she could say, you know, I support this socialist action, and then here I am an anarchist, but then here I am getting involved in electoral politics. That was a world, so it was fluid.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is Michael Hellquist. He is the author of Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. That's published by Oregon State University Press. So I wonder if you could paint a picture of radicalism at the beginning of the 20th century, the time when really you're talking about where Marie Equi became increasingly radicalized and increasingly active. What did radical politics, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, look like at that time?
Well, you know, people were fully aware of the harm and the injustice that accompanied much of industrialization and capitalism. And there was just a huge amount of organizing. It seemed more possible to be radical. It was a range of political involvements for people at the time. But in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of it's centered around agriculture, but especially the forests, different from the East Coast. So you had a lot of transient men trying to find jobs, and women in agriculture and canneries trying to get jobs, and then suffering from the low wages, the deplorable working conditions, and the rest. That tended to radicalize people, and they Some just wanted an improvement in their conditions, which is understandable. They were just trying to get through their day and support themselves and their families. Others said, you know, small improvements isn't going to do it. It's the whole economic order that needs to be changed. And she moved into that direction. And the industrial workers of the world had a very strong base in Portland and in the Pacific Northwest for about a decade. And one of the first strikes by the IWW in Portland was, I believe, in 1907. And so even before ECWI got involved, it was in the environment, in the newspapers. People talked about it. She understood that. Plus, Emma Goldman, on her national tours, stopped in Portland every year. And she freely spoke about radical elements. It wasn't... Sometimes she met resistance. Sometimes she was jailed, Emma Goldman. But generally, she was able to talk about her anarchism and her beliefs in it. So it was kind of a bubbling over, and with the labor rights push, things got more fierce, more violent by the forces of capitalism, more violent. And it kept building kind of up to the point, and including the point of getting ready for World War I. So it was a tense time, but it also seemed to be a time of possibility.
And we'll talk more about all the politics around World War I as we go on. But I wonder if you could describe the reigning ideas of the time, because the left at that time was not as polarized as it later became between people who might identify as socialists. You even kind of alluded to this in ECWI's own politics, communists, anarchists. So a group like the IWW, what sort of politics were they advocating, and to what degree did it range beyond just the politics of the workplace?
For the IWW, it was mostly, I believe, mostly about the workplace. And they were not as organized a force as we might believe that they had been. Free speech was really important to them. And they often staged challenges on street corners and see what would happen and then start a battle.
And what did free speech mean to them? Was this the right to organize and to speak to organize?
It was simply the right to get on a soapbox on the street corner and say whatever they wanted to say. And usually what would happen is one speaker would get up, the police would come along, pull him or her off, and cart them off to jail. Another one would get up, and that would continue. So it was a constant battle. And then Portland also had a mayor who wasn't just concerned about free speech and whether people were saying or proposing the wrong change. He didn't like the words they were using. So it offended him. It was obscenities to him. That sort of charged him up even more. And he would tell people, you cannot go out and you can't speak that way or you will be arrested. And that were a few of the occasions when ECWI got arrested and was beat up on the street and in jail during a third degree process and radicalized her even more.
In terms of the kind of larger ideas of the time, you mentioned Emma Goldman. Mm-hmm. She was someone who clearly identified as an anarchist, and her politics were very much what might be seen in this day as workerist, but it didn't just stop there because she had all sorts of very strong views about sexuality, the place of women in society. I wonder if you could just give us a sense of that kind of wide-ranging ideas, because you said that it wasn't just oppositional, but there was a sense of possibility to transform the world. So in a sense, there was a kind of utopian element, not just a saying no, but a yes.
Well, one thing to think of, not to overwork the IWW, but their notion was for one big union, which meant not just the trade unionist movement, which is standard today as well, but more this notion that we have one big group that represents us all. And I think that typified a lot of the notion of radicalism, that we should all move forward, we should all be in the boat lifting up. We should all get the benefits of a job and housing and, you know, the adequate resources that we need. So there was a hopeful sense there. Certainly as today, there was an extremist view that wanted violent overthrow of the government. There were others who thought violence could be used in particular circumstances, and Emma Goldman had pursued that in her life as well. And so I think the really sense is the potential, the opening up, and then of course that did enter into social life and certainly sexual life for Emma Goldman. And it's one of the things that I think was really important about Equi is that she didn't give a lot of speeches and talks and writings like Emma Goldman, but she lived her life that way. I mean, just to reflect, excuse me, back a moment, when she was in the Dalles, Oregon, on the homestead, there was a ruckus that was caused there that she was involved in, and she and her girlfriend appeared in the newspapers, and it was described, their living circumstances were described, and I believe that was the first case where, in the public, where same-sex intimate relationship was presented, and this was 1893. And then Equi was involved in another such case in Portland in 1906. So I think it was really important that either because of her independence and determination, but also the times, that in some ways she could live openly with a woman and not fear it.
Well, let me ask you more about her sexuality. She, in many ways, was a trailblazer in loving whom she wanted to and actually creating a family that went against traditional norms of families. How was lesbianism viewed at that time, and how might it differ to the way that lesbianism has been viewed in our times?
Interestingly, during her time in the 1890s and early 1900s, lesbian and lesbianism wasn't a words that were used. So it's like we don't have a language to talk about what we see going on here. But it was also at an early point where in psychological and sexological circles, the different sex choices, preferences, whatever you want to call it, weren't as defined. So it was a little fluid state already. Now, Equi living with someone on a small homestead, some people have referred to that as a Boston marriage, which was more popular in the Boston area, but that usually involved wealthy women, independent women already, which didn't really apply.
So this is a union between women, upper class women,
right, and without the need to rely on men.
And a term that was used without great scorn?
In certain circles, maybe respectable circles, it was just something that happened. But for Equi, she was doing this on her own in her own way. She was working class. And I think that was remarkable, and it ties into how she, actually throughout her life, coincident to the program name, she really was against the grain. She was an outsider most of her life, and the sexuality part really kept her there, so that even when she became a professional and a doctor and you'd think outsider no more, actually she still was. So I think with women, people didn't talk about it very much. And women living together was often considered just something that was done. They were waiting for a husband. People just didn't. Or there would be gossip and there would be talk. But I think it's only when Equi became so public and then so political and controversial, then all these things started coming together, and she ultimately was referred to as a degenerate and an unsexed woman, and she ran into the full brunt of her relationships. And I think she's the first publicly known lesbian of her time on the West Coast. And it's not so important to be identified as the first, but it does help establish some ground of people, we were there, that sort of thing.
And especially as it intersects with a radical politics.
Especially.
Which viewed sexuality as and sexual liberation as part of a larger project.
It did. It wasn't necessarily a priority for a lot of radical individuals and organizations, but women were involved. People like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn were really pushing all the time to get more people involved with the IWW and the Communist Party later.
So one place where Marie Ecuy was quite active around sexuality was in her medical work. She provided abortions and birth control information at a time when such things were actually illegal. Can you tell us about the medical work that she did and how she viewed it through her political lens?
Well, the first part of it is easier to answer. She had a general practice, but it was the norm at the time that most women doctors would mostly be serving women and children and then families, which sometimes involved husbands and et cetera. But she was never solely just dealing with women. And it's important that she did get involved with providing abortions. And we can't pinpoint when she did. It was sometime between 1905 and 1915. And at that time, it certainly was illegal in the city. And she provided safe, discreet abortions and early in term. So I think they were very safe. It was pretty simple, relatively simple procedure. And she didn't get in trouble with the law. There were larger operations, just abortion operations. Sometimes some people called them abortion mills. She always did it individually. And other doctors who were protecting their reputation would refer their patients to her so that she could take what risk there was and perform them. And with birth control, it was also illegal to distribute birth control information. And actually this year, this summer will be the 100th anniversary of when Margaret Sanger first went on a national tour, arrived in Portland, gave a talk. Her supporters started to distribute her birth control pamphlet called Family Limitation, and they were arrested. And it set in motion a series of events where a second talk by Sanger. Both Sanger and Ecuy and other women were arrested simply for distributing these pamphlets that said how to with the information and technology and products available at the day. So I don't know of any other doctor in Portland, I'm sure there were some elsewhere, who not only helped women with birth control but fought with them in the streets, marched through town, went to jail. So again, she was a little bit protected having her professional status, but you know, it didn't help her in the eyes of some people either.
Well, birth control is one place where radical history can get a little complicated because people like Margaret Sanger, Emma Goldman, the people who believe that they were helping women seize control of their destiny by allowing them to have this fundamentally important information. But then someone like Sanger also ended up supporting eugenics, which was a politics around saying that certain undesirable people should not reproduce, you know, the poor generally, the ethnically outside. Are you aware if Marie Ecuy ever was an advocate of eugenics as well? I know she was close to Sanger, perhaps even involved with her romantically at some point.
I don't know for sure that she was. And I think it's a little tricky area. It's a nuanced area with Margaret Sanger. I think most of her time in her association, early association with Ecuy, the conflict about eugenics wasn't as developed. I think, Margaret Sanger shifted in her own life from being more radical to being more conservative. And so I think it wasn't happening right about at that period. And I think even her support was pretty nuanced about what did she really mean and who was she talking about. And it's easier to kind of capsulize it and say she was in favor of eugenics. And sort of the context, I think, is important there.
That's the voice of Michael Hellquist. We'll return with him in just a moment.
Siegfried so soon on the Dunbar end. Everyone sang when strangers became your new best friends. This day and peace broke out. Everyone sang. Sometimes a melody is loud.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with independent scholar and author Michael Hellquist, who's author of the first full-length biography of the anarchist lesbian doctor Marie Equi, who was born in 1872 and died in 1952. And I should say Equi is spelled E-Q-U-I. And my name is Sasha Lilly. So, Michael, let's turn now to the lead-up to World War I, which was a very politically charged period in U.S. history, and of course a time when there had been a great deal of radical ferment, and in the wake of it, as we'll get to, a lot of that ferment was sort of beaten back. How did someone like Marie Equi view the U.S.'s turn towards entering World War I, and how did they swim against the current of politics around them?
I think she viewed it through the prism of capitalism. Who's to benefit from this war begun in Europe among European powers, among European capitalists, and what are the forces that are urging, encouraging the U.S. to enter the war? What are the domestic forces? And I think she was pretty sharp, pretty clear about that. And leading up to World War I, there was a period certainly of isolationism in the country, and Americans weren't sure that they wanted to have the country jump into the war, but there was this interim phase, this initial phase called preparedness. And not everyone, certainly, but a majority of Americans thought, well, yes, we don't know if we want to go to war, but if we must, we want to be prepared. And it became this national, hyper-nationalism surge in every city, small city and large city, hosted what were called preparedness parades, 100,000 people marching down the street. And, you know, it was festive, and it was determined, and people were unified, and it was a good feeling for all of them in there. Those big group in Portland didn't include Marie Equi. On the Preparedness Day parade in Portland, there were 50,000 people who came out, filling up 40 city blocks. Not a great number, 15,000 for us today, but Portland was a much smaller town, of course. It was a big deal. And there were one contingent after another of different interest groups going through downtown. Equi started the day. She had a big car, and she had signs festooned on it. She did have an American flag on the front, but then on the side, she had a sign that was basically saying, capitalists want you to join the war, you know, for their own good, and thou shalt not kill. So after driving around Portland, she came into downtown Portland, and she maneuvered her car behind an attorney's group, and I think it was the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic group. So there she was, all by herself. There was no other known dissent in the parade but her, with the big car, and she's, here I am. And, you know, the interesting thing is she knew from the 1913 cannery strike that men would not hesitate to beat her up. It had happened. She knew that the police would not protect her. In fact, back then, they took her into the police station and beat her up more. So even knowing that, she still did it. And I think it's remarkable. I mean, it might seem risky, reckless, but definitely bold, courageous. And it's what she thought should be done. So she was there within, I don't know how long, a few minutes. 50 angry men surrounded her. And she was a slight woman, about 5'3", 5'4", 50 angry men yelling at her. They ripped the banner off her car and the one she was carrying, ripped it to shreds, and then thrust the American flag in her face that had been on the street and was dirty. And they said, kiss this. And then they said, well, rip this apart, because they were, I guess, were trying to get evidence against her. And she just said, no, said, your flag is no protection for me. And she got beat up. And the police finally intervened and broke it up, and the parade went on. But it was that kind of determination on her part, and the national spirit was greater. So, and that was like in 1916. The U.S. entered the war in 1917. So that was early on. And, of course, that radicalized her more, and she had more of a platform then. So she spoke out against the war. The IWW didn't take a strong position against the war. They wanted to focus on their issues, and they thought, capitalists are fighting with capitalists. We don't really care what, that's simplifying it some, but we don't really care what the outcome is. And it was interesting, a conflict that also developed for ECWI. Here she was, a longtime suffragist. Oregon women had already won the right to vote in 1912, but nationally it was still pending. So in the election of 1916, President Woodrow Wilson, the incumbent, was running against Charles Evans Hughes from the Republican side, and Wilson would not commit to the federal suffrage amendment, but he was making these statements, I kept the country out of the war, suggesting that he would again. And Charles Evans Hughes from the Republican side had endorsed the suffrage amendment. So in the suffrage camp, most women went to Charles Evans Hughes to take care of their issue. ECWI did just the opposite. She went with Woodrow Wilson because he was supposedly against the war. And it just shows some of the clashes that were going on in the movements at the time, similar to today, people taking sides and what that meant for them.
What you describe of how ECWI took on solo this patriotic crowd, one could say mob, or it seems like it turned into a mob. She seems like an exceptionally fearless person, and not just in that moment. Obviously, living her life out of the closet the way she did was one aspect of that. But she also seemed like someone who was really not afraid of risking her physical well-being for her principles. I want to talk more about World War I, but, you know, that's really very striking.
I think it was a matter of priorities in her mind. Do the right thing. And it was also this edge about her is of, don't push me around. You know, that was just, it was fierce. Call it independence, call it oversensitivity to conflict, whatever. But she was determined about that. And I think she didn't want to show her fear. So she often appears fearless, like she didn't give it a second thought. She later talked in letters to Margaret Sanger and to others of how frightening it was, and how, like, when she got this third degree treatment from the police, that, like, she said her womanhood revolted because of the treatment to her, and she was terrified about it. So there was this vulnerability that didn't show as often because she presented herself as strong, indomitable, as partly her defense.
So, of course, Woodrow Wilson actually did take the U.S. into World War One, and as a consequence, there was a very intense backlash against the left, against radicals, under the umbrella of the nation standing together. Tell us about that, a Red Scare in many ways, more intense than the McCarthy period.
Yes, it was. Once the U.S. entered the war, the national spirit and unity shifted. Support our boys, support the national effort. And it became as intense, if not more so, than the kind of hyper-nationalism around the preparedness. And it was a time when little dissent was allowed. And partly in the early stages of the war, the president and the president's men decided that they had to keep convincing the American public that the war was a good thing, because not everyone moved from isolationism to support of the war. And one way to do that was a communications campaign that put out the pro-war statements. The other part was to slap down dissent. And in time, Congress passed the Espionage Act and then the Sedition Act, which together virtually said you cannot criticize anything the government does, anything, publicly. You cannot do that. And you cannot stir up conflict or criticize any of the war industries, which, of course, could be most anything. The war, who's supporting the war and not. Most everyone was, if only for commercial reasons, the businesses were. So it was really a clampdown on, certainly on free speech, but it got to the point where protesters, where people could not gather in like more than three at a time in a public space and talk about their opposition to the war or anything else.
And what were the consequences for Marie Ecuy?
For Marie Ecuy, it meant that she was arrested and she was charged under the Sedition Act. And basically, she was charged with speaking out against the war. No one said she worked with she wasn't charged with working with a small group that was going to blow up some building. No one said that she was calling for the overthrow of the government. She was opposing the capitalists. She was opposing things like the Liberty Loan efforts to raise money for the war. And she was charged. She went to trial. It dragged out for quite a while. And then she was convicted by an all-male jury. And she was sentenced to 3 years in prison. President Wilson commuted her sentence to a year and a day, and the day had something to do with her eligibility for early release. And she ended up going to San Quentin, which she was actually pleased to go to San Quentin. There was another prison in the Midwest, I think in Iowa, that was more of a reform prison or rehabilitation. She said, I'm too old to reform. Just send me to prison in San Quentin, and I know the Bay Area. I'm fine.
Why do you think Wilson reduced her sentence?
Partly because the war was ended. She was a doctor. She had a lot of supporters, especially once the war was not really an issue of something we were fighting anymore. And there was a lot of flack being sent to Washington, to the Attorney General, and to Wilson. And so he didn't pardon her, but he did reduce her sentence. And even though I say that she was charged and convicted of sedition, you get the sense through her trial and other documentation that I got, this was really about silencing a troublesome woman. Her anti-war statements were the hook. But here was this open lesbian. Here was this relatively well-known abortion provider. Here's this one who was in the labor strikes, was involved with the Wobblies. They just didn't want to deal with her, and they feared her because she had power. People listened to her.
We're speaking about the anarchist and lesbian doctor Marie Ecuy, who lived her life primarily in the Pacific Northwest and was incarcerated, as is just being described, during World War I in San Quentin. My guest is the author of the first full-length biography of her. The book is called Marie Ecuy, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. His name is Michael Hellquist. He is a journalist and historian, and I am Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you have written that Ecuy was exceptional in being incarcerated in San Quentin. Now, obviously, there was a great deal of repression that was taking place, but it seems like she particularly, as you've just been noting, was targeted for a particularly high level of repression.
Correct. She was not the only woman to be incarcerated, certainly. She wasn't the only woman from Oregon to be in San Quentin, which still had women prisoners, inmates there. She was the only one on these charges. They were called politicals. It was a small population, but she was the only one there. And historians have been able to get copies of her correspondence for 4 months from prison. And you get a picture of her life in prison, but it's also pretty clear that she knew they were being read and censored as need be. And I think for her friends who she was writing to, she mostly kept a pretty upbeat appraisal of what she was dealing with. But with a few, she would talk about the severe difficulties she had. She said she had to force herself to not think about no longer being a doctor at her practice and to not think about the injustice done to her, or she would just revert to what she called a brain fever. It was just so upsetting for her.
Obviously, prison is hard on people's bodies, and for her, it took a physical toll as well as an emotional one.
Definitely. I mean, here is a 50-year-old woman who was sent to prison, and this wasn't San Quentin for the women. It wasn't like some of the other prisons where women had to work 8 to 10 hours a day, laundromat or sewing or whatever. If anything, they didn't have much to do at all. They were kind of in a concrete box, and they could look up and see the sky out in the courtyard in Marin, but that was all. It had to have been really difficult for her, who partly was accustomed at that time to finer, to say, like, to better eating, to good quality food. She wasn't able to get that there. And, you know, there would just be so much noise. You know, it would make it difficult to rest. She talked about in the first several weeks, she was terrified when in her cell, the door was shut at night. She was so claustrophobic, it just kind of freaked her out. And I think it just took a huge psychological strain. Plus, the whole time, she was trying to get out of prison while she was incarcerated. And this is a time when all she had access to was writing letters, maybe every now and then a telephone call. And she was trying to coordinate it. I mean, imagine today trying to coordinate the paperwork and you talk to you. And that made her a little crazy in a sense, too, because it was so difficult and people didn't follow through and there were glitches and et cetera.
To what degree did her life change upon her release from prison?
Well, the world had changed, not only for her, but certainly for other radicals. She wasn't really able to be politically active, certainly to the same degree, because the post-war Red Scare was just as frightening as before. People were not able to gather, were not able to talk among each other or to the public. She told Margaret Sanger that anyone who had a public hall would be threatened with closure if they let her speak or anyone else speak. So she was really shut down that way. And initially she wasn't sure if she wanted to go back to her medical practice. She thought she might work for prison reform instead, and she did that for a few months. But others were already on the prison reform circuit. So she went back to what she knew best, to the practice of medicine. And she continued that for as long as her health held out, until 1930, when she had a heart attack and retired from her practice, although she was to live for another 20 years.
Tell us about her last years. She had become close to someone who you've mentioned already, the leader of the IWW, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who herself was on a changing political trajectory.
Right. Well, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was younger than Equi by several years, she was the hero of the IWW. She started speaking out on these issues when she was 16, and this young woman was, you know, all these men working out in the forest and everything else, and they had this young woman who would speak their cause. It was amazing for them. So she was very popular. She was a national figure, whereas Equi was more regional and local. But in 1927, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was traveling through the country, and by the time she got to Portland, she was having health problems and almost the equivalent of a nervous breakdown because of all the stress involved of failed relationships, personal relationships on her part, and the politics in the country at the time. And she ended up stopping in Portland and asking Marie Equi to take care of her. And she did have some severe health problems, seemingly first with her heart and then with something even like an infected tooth, which the infection then spread throughout the body. So one doctor that Marie arranged, a specialist that Marie arranged for Gurley Flynn to see, said you have to have bed rest for 5 years because there were no medications or any treatments. The important thing, and Gurley Flynn stayed there with Equi on and off for a period of 9 years. So Curly Flynn resigned from all of her political activities. And there they were on this hillside outside on the edge of Portland in Equi's house. She had a house at that time. And they spent all these years there. Partly Equi took care of Curly Flynn, and then Curly Flynn took care of Equi after her heart attack. But the important thing is that this was also during the Depression. And Curly Flynn really had nowhere else to go. Her family in New York did not have money to support her. And Equi gave her free lodging, free board and large lodging, and said, please help me out with the house and maybe some of the books for my business and that sort of thing. And they developed a very complicated, what might appear now, a codependent relationship now. And some people, especially relatives of Curly Flynn, was really concerned that Curly Flynn's reputation would be tarnished by living with this lesbian, you know, and all the terrible things that could happen as a result. So it was a pretty interesting time in her life also.
Well, in the last minutes that we have, I'd like to ask you how you came to know about Marie Equi, because she's not someone who has either been celebrated by the radical left or the lesbian and gay community, at least as far as I'm aware. And yet, you know, she's a really remarkable figure. How did you come across her?
The first thing, what triggered my interest is I went to a website from the Pacific Northwest called the Gay Lesbian Archives of the Pacific Northwest. And there was an article there about the period when Equi was on the homestead in Oregon. And at that time, her girlfriend was a school teacher, and she was not being paid a full salary by the superintendent. They tried to get the money, And finally, Equi said, enough of this. She grabbed a horsewhip, and she horsewhipped this guy, who also happened to be a Baptist minister, in the center of town in the middle of the day, and became a local heroine for doing so because he was kind of a fraudulent character. So my first orientation was, let's see, 21-year-old lesbian horsewhipping Baptist minister to defend her girlfriend. Okay, I want to know more. But then the other thing was that I really connected was this, on a more personal level, is Equi was this outsider because of her background, her working-class background, and her sexuality. And I personally identified with that. And I wanted to know, how did she manage this 100 years ago? How did this happen? And then, why isn't her story known? And I think partly, or a good part of the reason why her story isn't better known, was because of her outlaw sexuality, because she was lesbian and others didn't want to deal with that. Plus, to a lesser degree, her radical politics. I mean, certainly Goldman and Curly Flynn were radical. I think it was the lesbian part that kept her at a distance. And another factor was there weren't as many sources from her life. Her journals had been thrown away, and that discouraged people. But obviously, it's possible to put a life together, even if you don't have all the documentation that you would like, and keep someone from being hidden from history.
And for someone who would like to know more about that hidden history heretofore, you can check out Marie Equi, Radical Politics and Outlaw Passions. It's published by Oregon State University Press, and we have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Its author is Michael Hellquist, journalist and historian. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.